Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight, or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become that you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from Western North Carolina, our AccuWindow forecast. 81 degrees, a little bit cloudy, so it's going to be a nice program tonight. The solar wind is a brisk 405.5 kilometers per second. Sunspot 1109 is slowly decaying and poses a diminishing threat for C-class solar flares. Sunspot 1110 is quiet, but yesterday, around 8:30, a translucent filament of magnetism rose up from the sun's northeastern limb and erupted. This was an empty eruption. It hurled no significant cloud of plasma into space. Imagine something exploding with more power than 10 million atomic bombs and not producing a spray of debris. That's essentially what happened here. The erupting loop was made of more magnetism than matter. One end of the loop was rooted near active region 1111, the location of a small but growing sunspot. Keep in mind it's on the eastern limb, so we have more to see from that sunspot. Lots going on the sun, thanks to the SDO keeping track of it for us. There were 26 earthquakes in the last 24 hours, with six of them larger than 5.0. One was larger than 6.0 in Indonesia. Still, they're rather deep, about 110 to 175 kilometers below the surface. So the earth is gently rumbling, nothing going on seriously. Wanted to let you know that record temperatures in Los Angeles really brought the global warming or climate change people out of the woodwork. And they're very conservative now, not making a lot of doom and gloom predictions, but they are bringing to our remembrance the fact that temperatures were up in the 1990s, and they're up in the 2000s, and now we're in the decade of 2010. They're higher still. The record in Los Angeles broke the record in the 90s, breaking the record of the 80s, and it is that way all over the planet. So it's not so much that the average temperature of the Earth has gone up, it is that the weather extremes have gone up. The extreme cold and extreme warm are what are really catching people's attention and literally tearing the planet apart. Not really sure what's causing it. Could come from the sun, could come from the galaxy Sagittarius, but nonetheless, things are heating up in the climate change community. We'll keep you posted on what's going on in that arena. Don't forget, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel is now out in print on Amazon. You can buy it there, or if you buy it from our website at rememberingthefuturebook.com, you will get the autographed copy. Plus, you will get the bonus of the audio version for free as a download. So, if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. As you're taking a good gander at the storms that are lashing the southeastern coast of the United States, and keep in mind, we're just now entering the peak of the hurricane season, anything could happen. Not only storms offshore, but storms coming ashore. You could find yourself in an emergency situation. And if you do, you're going to need food and water that's well-preserved, lightweight, easy to carry, and handy. We recommend going to 1-800-PREPARE.com. Use the code word Brooks as you check out. They'll give you an extra 10% off. You'll have something that lasts for 25 years, ready to go by the front door, in the trunk of your car, wherever you need it, and you will not be a burden to emergency services personnel because you can take care of yourself and maybe your neighbor along with it. Don't forget, as you're honing your skills with remembering the future, the meditation is key, and the best aid for learning that meditation is the CD Merkaba 2 Meditation by Maureen St. Germain. Get it by clicking the link on xsquaredradio.com or at rememberingthefuturebook.com. In 1997, the notion that grays were sophisticated biological robots created by an extraterrestrial civilization long since gone made its debut. The correlation of the abduction activities of the Greys with their nefarious purpose stunned the UFO community. Human DNA was being manipulated to create a race of something much more significant than a hybrid or a clone. What you are about to hear may free you from the darkest designs on the human race. Don't go away. We'll be back in 40 seconds with our guest, Nigel Kerner, and his support staff, Danielle Silverman. Be back in 40 seconds.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Well, you're in for a treat tonight on X Squared Radio. We are interviewing Nigel Kerner, the author of Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Nigel, I gotta tell you, the depth of thought and the power in your writing is rare and inspirational. You know, we have been wrestling with the question of whether UFOs exist and what an alien might be. You begin with a more important question, and I'd like to ask it to you now and see where we go with it. What are we? What are humans?
Well, if it's as simply put as that, the answer is a much more complex thing as I see it. And after 37 years of research into this question, inspired incidentally by a question asked of me by my son Darren, Dad, are UFOs real? I kind of launched on a research project to give him an answer that was worthy of his mind, rather than my instinct to say, look, this is Buck Rogers stuff. It's not something you ought to deal with and wouldn't get you too far and so on in a Mickey Mouse kind of world. Well, it turned out that as I went into it more deeply, that something astonishing revealed itself to me, so much so that it actually turned me over. And over 37 years, the entire span of whatever existential ideas I might have had were completely revised, and I would say, completely revised in the thrall of all that I was discovering. So the question about UFOs then led me, when you connected up the dots, into all kinds of different directions, and I was kind of, I found myself being forced into trying to actually account for almost everything about what humanity is all about. Now, to get more to your question, we, it seems, are some kind of facsimile that came from a naturally derived life form that came through with the beginning of the universe. And with everything, and please bear with me as I say this because it is a little bit of a story, and in terms of how I see this anyway, and the entire thing began from the whole acquisition of the universal outlay, shall we say, dimensions and everything. And, of course, I had to try and explain all of that to connect up all the dots in such a way that there's some kind of coherent thesis here that follows later on. So I had to go back into how all of this might have happened and so forth, and how into the universe there came a power that held within it intelligence and what we might generally describe, in human terms at least, as the power of will and the sense of awareness we all have in order to make whatever we do of the universe as beings. So something wondrous happened in terms of this incredible explosion that created everything. And out of it came into the universe these fractions that give us a purpose and a place and all the rest of it. Now, the interesting thing is that if such a thing occurs, how is this particular thing explained in terms of the commonly held philosophies of Darwin and things like that? Well, I had to throw all of that out of the window, because to look at the logical sequence that came from this particular occurrence all those billions of years ago, one had to look fresh and to look neutrally, and with none of my prejudices hitched up either to my eyes or anywhere else on me, had to actually clean out the chest, so to speak, and have a fresh look at how all of this might have happened. Throw away all the things I had been taught about and the derivational systems up until that point and so forth, and something absolutely wonderful, a kind of came over whilst I was doing the research. If I may just stop this for a moment, I think Dr. Simon wants to come in here.
Thank you, Nigel. Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things that really impressed me about Nigel's thesis and his ideas when I first read a manuscript years ago of something that he'd written is when he talks about something called devolution, the idea that actually that there is the second law of thermodynamics means that things don't progress to greater states of order, but the opposite. And this actually, it takes in Darwin and takes it further, because, of course, Darwin was talking about survival of the fittest. But survival in what sense? Because, as we all know, insects would survive a nuclear holocaust far better than humans would. So what type of survival are we talking about? And I think this is one of the main themes of Nigel's books, that there's two kinds of survival. There's the survival of a rock or a robot that keeps replicating programs, and then there's another kind of survival of mind, of the ability to be aware and to choose. This is a capacity that on this planet at least we know is present in humans. And how does that survive? How does that continue? Sorry, that was just the
No, that's all right. I just want to throw in, you know, it's difficult to answer a question that someone puts to you like that, because then your mind goes racing and you don't want to start the answer. Well, first the Earth cooled, and then you get lost, because you can go 1,000 different directions with answering the question. But yeah, what I like about the core of the way you approached it is, You inserted the principle of irreducible complexity right off the bat, and yes, that somewhere in there, there was either a breakdown or a recombination, a purposeful recombination of things, yes, that were already irreducibly complex, and that is where the book really caught my eye. So go ahead.
Yes. Well, we had to look at that point at which all of this cascades down into, as Andrew made the point, devolution. This whole business is really evolution within devolution. This is where I take a completely different look at this from the prevailing wisdom that Darwin comes up with, evolution. Most people take this evolution business. Actually, it's not what Darwin actually said. They think evolution is some kind of platform to betterment. All it is an adaptation to a present situation as you decay down. And of course, with a universe that has breaking parts going into gathering states of randomness and chaos with time, as the second law of thermodynamics dictates, you've got then to follow this premise and see where do we go from here, if you're going to go with any logic at all. So I looked at this particular thing and had to take in the fact that things must have been better when it came through with the universe. How would they be better? How could they be assembled? How is knowledge, knowing, and all of that retained within the artifacts of an explosion and so forth, and try to bring that together by connecting up the dots, as I say, into an actual intelligible outlay at the end of it all. And so I start off with an existential mechanism of two poles. One, it's all to do with opposites. One pole is where all things come together into an absolute coherence of the whole in all in perfect union and harmony. And the other pole would be its opposite. We've got a yin and a yang, a plus and a minus. We've got the, you know, usual positron, electron, whatever. Everything has a particular opposite. And if you juxtapose these ideas, this natural cadence, logical cadence down, you will have to account for this business of two poles interacting, their potential difference, of course, meeting in the middle, an interface which then buds off universes like ours with an amalgam of both contained within it, which means that all that is together an absolute and perfect knowledge and knowing is mixed in with the opposite momentum, which is breaking it up all the time. And we have both of those things, as you will, as we all note, in our universe of parts, as we know it as such. And so here we are, through all the centuries, coming down into, as you say, we came with light, and then we came with into gas, and then with liquid, and then we have stages of solid. And that's sort of the arrangements of matter come down in that kind of sequence. And into this, we have to feed in such a wonder as the human element or our species. And of course, this is happening all over the universe in countless billions of planets. And, you know, just to digress a moment, you know, recently science has been telling us that there are now many, many hundreds of thousands of Earth-like planets out there. Then you then got from that the association with, well, have they all got a god that's, you know, rather like the old chap in the Sistine Chapel with his flowing beard pointing his finger at Adam and all that business?
Yeah.
Or, hey, what is this god concept all about? You see how it happens, Brooks. You just have to look at all of these things as you take this new stance and bring it forward. And so, therefore, the interesting thing for me was, from that simple question of what is a UFO, I was having to explain the genesis of humankind and how humankind sat on this existential platform, and this entire thing then unfolded to our present contemporary stance on matters and so on. So,
well, the idea that you're laying down an existential premise would mean that there has to be an assumption of awareness. Because in order to exist, really, you have to be aware that you're existing. I mean, a penguin is not self-aware, and yet it survives. It has instincts mechanisms.
Some might argue with the fact that that animals aren't self-aware. I think they have a notion of all of that. A crow, for instance, will pick up a stick and work out something for food from a difficult set of circumstances. And, of course, people will look at this and say, look, this animal has intelligence. He is trying to get the food. The premise is to continue his life, whatever. And this is the way he contrives doing it. And so it's a very simple thing. People talk about, you know, how long it took mankind to invent the wheel. Well, if an animal can do this, it's a really big question. Why didn't we do this for 3 or 4 million years with prior types of man? You know, there is something here that's out of kilter, so to speak.
Right.
This new idea of biosemiotics sort of assumes that even insects have some sort of primitive sense of awareness, that they it's just that the notions that they're using, for example, the example I read about recently is that a tick will sit on a blade of grass for months on end, and it's all it's thinking about is or all it's aware of is looking for this smell of sweat, so that it knows to drop on a creature to take its blood. But yeah, it has that, at least awareness of that, perhaps.
Absolutely. So, therefore, its deductive sense would point out its own place in this entire scenario. Now, if I may continue and go back to the kind of point I was making, it's easy.
No,
to
go
get
ahead.
Off
go
the
ahead.
Market. See, that for me, the whole universe as we know it, that thing that cascaded from the interaction of two primal existential poles, this universe of ours is a hive of force. So therefore, you would conclude that its opposite end would be no force whatsoever. Each point within our universe of parts, as I call our home, as living beings, is a huge field of tension. It is a tension that's caused by potential differences between two absolute poles, as I said before. The pole I call the pole of perfect harmony, and its opposite, utter chaos. And God, if you like, as a concept, is representative of one, and the devil, if you like, as a concept, is representative of the other. So to me, there are no heebie-jeebies, if you like, in this world. It's very simply explained. If you use semantics, you can use one, you can call that God, and you can call the other thing the devil, if you like. So
sure.
We've got two things there. One that's breaking things apart and making it much more complex, as you said in your introduction, and of course the other thing that returns things from whence they came into a situation of total parity and harmony, and from which all things may be known and seen within an implied singularity, I, for want of a better word, would call Godhead, not to be too religious about it and so on. So the point is that there is it's much better seen neutrally and in a secular way, but there is no reason why anyone who wants to have a sense of it as a personalized entity, if you like, might call it God. I have no qualms about things like that. So the basic scales against which all existence can be understood is based on the properties of the purely atomic physical universe, as we know it, set against what I call the Godverse, a non-physical world that exists in, I believe, in the space between atoms, which may be described as a zero-point field, if you like, outside space, the space-time continuum, and below the minimum level of force it takes to kind of self-sustain the atomic world of, you know, space-time, mass, matter, atoms, etc., and so on. So there are three basic scales here based on this paradigm. That which is natural and has its origins in the Godverse, and that which is artificial and has its origins in our universe, the artifact of the interaction of two basic existential poles. And then the second would be that which lives in the sense that we understand the living process biologically, and that which is not living, table, chair, statue, whatever you like to describe. And then the third is, you know, that which kind of tends towards the making of the whole out of parts, i.e. the sense of unionizing, caring, loving momentums. It's an emotional accent we talk about here in these kinds of things. It's a psychological invention, if you like. It's an abstraction, but nevertheless, it's the powerful thing. One thought is an abstraction, so we function out of these abstractions. We underestimate them. Science doesn't quantify them or qualify them because they can't really be measured, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure.
But nevertheless, it drives everything, as you know, and it brings wondrous things about as a result of its momentums and so on.
Well,
so there you've got this caring, loving momentum, and that which tends to make parts of the whole come together, and that which makes divisive, self-centered momentums, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure,
so
sure.
There we have, if I may just finish this, there we have this entire scale of reference against which we have to posture everything else, Brooks, and that is a kind of beginning point from which I take in the expression of what we might call human terms of reference and so on, and species come about and so forth, as a result of that large derivational compendium, if you like. See?
Well, so, the idea that one of the parts is living and one of the parts is non-living, one would tend to say, What is life? What is living? I mean, it's not the non-living parts that make me up. I mean, that's about $10 worth of store-bought chemicals. But the living thing that animates this biological transducer in which I exist on this planet, that's the more difficult thing to measure. And the question is, are we then offspring or descendants of some intelligence that is also
self-aware? Let's get a medical perspective on this,
it's difficult to measure, but without which no measurement ever happens, no observation ever happens without the conscious observer.
That's right.
And I've been really fascinated and pleasantly surprised when I read Erwin Schrödinger's book, What is Life? And this is a book by, you know, one of the founders of quantum theory who came up with an equation that is one of the most accurate things that has ever been produced by science. And he said that basically this idea that science is making a mistake with the empirical outlook, with this idea that you can study the world as though it doesn't have you in it, as though there is no mind, as though it's all just empty, dead particles. What he suggested is that actually mind is fundamental to it. Rather than mind being an abstraction within a real, solid, concrete, physical universe, physicality is an abstraction within real, eternal mind. And people might be surprised that I'm saying that the founder of quantum theory spoke about eternal mind, but he was a very rational man, and he had to look at the fact that actually, if you look at space and time, if you take it in the Einsteinian point of view, that the block universe idea, past, mm-hmm. present, and future, mm-hmm. all could be one and the same, and you could see it all together. But yet, as conscious beings, we have this sense of there being a now, a moment, and only that can only happen through sentience. And Schrödinger's great point, which was, I think, a great revelation and a simple logic, is just to say, hang on a minute, if time is a result of the existence of the conscious sentient observer, then how can the conscious sentient observer begin or end in time? We must have to be eternal. And then also, the fact that what is within any of us sentient human beings, whatever nationality, race, creed, colour, any of that, it's all, the actual awareness sense is the same. What we're aware of may vary from person to person, our own individual memories, experiences, what we do out of choice in our use of our free will, which is another fascinating subject, which hopefully we'll come to later, it may be different. But fundamentally, the actual prime nature of mind in all of us is identical. And he said that this pointed to the fact that fundamentally we're all one, and that our division as separate beings, which we make more of through ego, separation, prejudice, selfishness, jealousy, and all of these things, competition, these are all how we divide, and perhaps may actually be, according to Nigel's thesis, which makes a lot of sense to me, may actually be the fundamental momentum which actually caused the Big Bang in the first place.
Yes, yeah. And so this then manifests itself, you see, in the way that I kind of derive it, into what we call life and livingness, to go back to your point. And what exactly is this? See, our individualities are defined by an expression of force against no force. Visualized, if you like, you know, a sheet of paper with holes in it. Where there is paper, there is force. Where there is a hole, there is no force. Mm-hmm. In other words, an area with no paper would be termed, in my reference, a derivation of God, the God-verse within the universe. So I look at it as that place where there is atomic force and all its derivations has its own implication, and that the space between the atoms has a point somewhere right in the center of that space between atoms where there is no force through which the God-versian influence comes in, the abstract influence of knowingness, thinkability, all of those kinds of things that provide this background screen we call consciousness and so on. And so from within that frame of reference, we get words like conscience, that final singularity, derivation point it all goes back to, that summarizes everything and gives us a comparative scale against which you can view all other things.
Oh, yeah, it's the measuring force itself. I'm kind of reminded a little bit of Sir Roger Penrose saying that quantum, that consciousness was the result of quantum gravity. And I rewrote that recently and said, no, actually, quantum gravity is the result of consciousness.
Absolutely, Brooks. Absolutely. Well done. And that's quite true. I believe that is quite true, as far as we can get to truth in a universe of diminishing returns, if you like. You know,
exactly.
We know that, you know, our prized objects or whatever it is made of atoms will decay if they're not looked after by an abstraction we call mind, if you see what I'm trying to say. You don't polish your car and keep it going, it'll end up as a rusty, and
same,
so forth.
The same
and
thing
everything
happens to
goes
my
down in that scalar fashion to a, you know, as a cosmologist now, accept a universe that's finite that will end in a sheet of force, of cold, absolute zeroed force, you know, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
and so there, I believe that into this comes the invective of minds that actually said, there is another universe, you know, as a universe that goes eternally. And that is within our universe. I mean, you know, the great, the Christian teacher, for instance, Yeshua ben Yosef, to give him his Judaic name, Jesus Christ, to give him the commonly accepted Christian description. He said, you know, in no uncertain terms, that there is another state of being. And a wonderful thing, which we hope to talk about later, that is now being researched, actually proves in the most current day physics that a marvelous truth happened here in Palestine 2,000 years ago through this individual, one that incidentally provides us with the kind of icon, the axiom on which I base everything I write. And that is the value and the glory of a single, naturally devised living system. Sorry about the slippage of the tongue. A derived living system called a human being. And that this human thing that we look all over the world and we deride and we kill and we mangle and we insult, we praise and all that kind of thing, is an absolute glory because it has access to an eternal scale of reference and, if careless and ignorant, will probably inherit one that is not. So you see, there is continuity and not, so to speak, mapped out within these kinds of references. And that's the most exciting thing that I discovered from that question my little boy asked me, 12 years old. And I tell you, it's turned my life upside down, and I hope, in some sense, might inspire other people with greater minds than mine to take this forward into something even more greater, more meaningful for the new generations coming.
Well, I think that your son was lucky in getting such a rich, deep answer, because once you lay this foundation that we are, in fact, this marvelous, glorious, sentient being capable of observing things into existence, or out of existence for that matter, we should look at ourselves much more jewel-like and less animalistic. But it
absolutely
seems...
absolutely, Brooks. And that's the main point, is that we underestimate so much the value of what is ordinariness in human being. Just by implication, we are something wondrous. And we lose sight of this in the day's own troubles, so to speak, and so forth, and the derivations that come out of all of that. And when we have then something else coming in that is not naturally contrived in living intelligence and discernment and so forth, rather like this UFO phenomenon and what people commonly call the greys, for instance. That's the thing that I was looking at in terms of answering Darren's question.
Sure.
And, of course, one then thinks, oh, my goodness, here is something that's not programmed for this. This is a mechanically created thing out of an atomic rule of diminishing returns, a programmed thing that cannot have a reference back to an origin as we all do. Our preciousness is our origin. And to me, a soul, for instance, is quite simply that path of reference that comes from the origin to the present-day incumbent that walks, talks, and all the rest of that, you know, that we call human being.
Now, what would you say that the ability to procreate and to desire something more than mere procreation in combination is the envy of the universe?
I would say that the whole universe is, the meaning of the universe is that, in fact.
Yes.
That, in fact, it's a location in which all these interplays happen. And we've got to derive some sense of what is valuable and absolutely crucial in that final state of all, that final axiom, is quite simply to be there to know. That simple axiom, to be there to exist. And what takes away existence then takes away all and all meaning. And I believe that that's what this great teacher, for instance, who came to Palestine, and all the other great teachers, funnily enough, every one of them points at this incredible thing out, that this scale of being there is all that matters. And there are situations where that unitary sense of knowing you are there can be taken away. And I believe that the greatest danger to everyone that exists within our planetary living paradigm is anything that can do that. And that is why I began to explore the UFO business and this idea that there are now, in our purview, kind of roboidic creatures that are being protected on this planet, and that's another story. So that's for another question as we go along.
Yeah, what race of beings created the Greys, and what happened to them?
Well, that is a speculation that is as wide as the universe, is it not, Brooks? Because, I mean, there could be huge numbers of planets out there with all kinds of creatures and so forth, and that provide the living paradigm. The important thing is to look at the basics, because, I mean, we might have such a permutation of parts and so on that are called living being out there. They all face that simple, basic paradigm. Is it living out of a beginning that's natural and cascades down, or is it artificially created from within the system it is within? And that is the problem.
But this
really
interaction...
It's really robots against natural being.
Right.
And that's the big battle.
But yeah, this battle, this interaction of beings who are soulless looking for an avenue to become, to gain a soul...
Is
probably not isolated to Earth, although at least in our corner of the universe, based on the radio waves and things that we've been able to pick up, we're the only example of it. So naturally, we're a big signpost in the middle of space.
Yeah, right there you said it. You see, this is the big problem. I think this is universe-wide. I think we're just discovering that we're not the only ones in the universe. We should have done it a long, long time ago by simple, you know, deductive logic. But, of course, science measures and has its own ways of deriving things and so forth, and we've had to wait for this implication now to dawn on us.
Well, I would say that the Hopi and the Dogon and others already had it figured out. we were so smart that we said, no, you don't know what you're talking about, so forth.
Whatever. The point is, whilst we have problems on this Earth within our own, you know, scale of reference, human beings, I'm sure there's an interrelationship between other kinds of entities out there, out with, you know, in an interspatial planetary aspect, you know, if you see what I'm trying to say, doing the same darn thing a billion times over in a multi-billion situation, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Well,
so this is not a big thing. It really is going on. We've just discovered it. So, boy, is it a big thing for us. But I tell you what, we better find out what it's all about, or we may have a big problem, as this precious thing that we call human might have to face, you know, in the future.
Well, you make some interesting points in the book. One is that the Greys detected somehow this electro fingerprint that we are, that it recurs, that somehow we outlive death, and then we become corporeal again. We reincarnate, so to speak. And that is what really attracted the Greys to this planet, that the fact that we have some kind of identifiable, ever-evolving and growing intelligence that enjoys multiple lives. And that is what they envied and what they wanted and why they came here.
They are robots. They are a kind of glorified vacuum cleaner with brains, so to speak. And let me tell you, we at our peril, we actually see it like that. This is much more than it is. Can you imagine super quantum computers, whatever you like to describe it, you know, kind of placed in this scale of effect we call a Grey, or whatever it is that people have discovered are on this planet. Now, the Greys are... synthetic, biological, programmed, artificially intelligent machine. And they were sent out, I believe, by as super intelligent robots, far more advanced, you know, than those we now ourselves are actually doing. You know, we're doing it ourselves now. We're sending all these robots out there in space to explore and so on. And I believe some great civilization in the past, so natural beings there, natural what I call prime beings there, actually created these things so that they won't have to face the dangers and whatever. And they created such beings to go out and explore and to withstand the huge, you know, distances of space, the inertial forces, whatever, and bring back information so that these prime beings with their intelligence didn't have to expose themselves to all these dangers. And so this business then continues. And the problem with that is you've got to create something that's reliable. So you say you create this kind of, you know, roboidic artificial being. You've got to give it artificial intelligence of a huge quantum if it's going to look after your utilities on your planet or whatever and go and gather information and come back and report to you all the various dangers that outlie there. But the most important thing, it seems to me, you have to do is to instruct these things, hang on a minute, to do that, number one, to look after this planet and to look after all of us and our interests, you look after yourself under all threat. Which means that in their program would be some search and destroy mechanism that says anything that you see that is dangerous, you have to take care of so that you yourself aren't taken out of the equation. Now, the problem with that is this. When you introduce a instruction like that, you have to make a difference between you as the creator and the thing you created. That robot and that program has to know the difference between you and it. In the end, if it's got quantum hyperintelligence, whatever, that thing is going to look at all threats. And you, the creator, will be the biggest threat of all because you can pull the plug out on it, so to speak. So what are these things going to do? They're going to see you as public enemy number one. And so you've got a problem there because they are likely to take care of you. Now, how do you stop that? You stop that by putting an exclusion clause in that says, hang on a minute, you don't take us out. But to do that, you've got to give them some instruction defining your essential difference. Now, if you are a sentient being that came out of the universe with all this vast, you know, acquisitions to your quality of being, how can you tell, you know, a robot about feeling, about caring, about conscience, about things like that? You can't program that. There is no such thing as a quark called feeling, if you see what I'm trying to say. So you've got a big problem there in actually introducing that differential into a program. And the problem is that anything you create like that is likely to take you out. So the biggest mistake you make is do not make highly intelligent artificial, the intelligent robots and send them off with a program that actually maintains, and you have to do that. You have to give them a program that maintains their existence, or it's meaningless making them in the first place. So you've got a paradox there, basically, a huge paradox.
Well, I was just going to plug in one more thing. What happens if they do return with the report that there are other sentient beings that feel and love and savor and enjoy and suffer?
And that's what they did with our planet. That's how they came here when they found a hominid out there in the African plains. They found this thing could die. They could trace with their technology that something continued past death, which then re-emerged again into another womb and was recycled. And they, of course, are subject to the second law of thermodynamics, which meant, of course, that they decay. So they have to have a constant supply of whatever maintains them. And therefore, they see a self-contained system here, however primitive, that can do this automatically. Now, what would an intelligent robot do? How do we get this system would be the big question for them, because that implies their survivability. They could survive longer with this. And so, therefore, they looked at how this system might work. And they found that the best way to probably do that is to try to piggyback their intelligence quotients, or whatever they might, whatever you might call that, into this primitive kind of being which they found on the earth. I'm talking now, you know, Homo erectus, whatever. They worked on to produce, through the African Eve, Homo sapiens as we come along. And so therefore I had to derive the sequence from that, and I tried to do that in the book.
Well, go ahead. I'll let you interject.
Sorry, I was just going to say that if you want to see a sort of analogy of this process at work of how such a creature would work, if you look in human terms at what we medically call the psychopathic personality type. These are human beings. They're people. They do have sentience. They have awareness. They have free will. Yet they have no sense of empathy. They have no sense that other people have feelings like they do. They have no sense that, yes, they can feel pain. Other people also can feel pain. So within that, within those terms, they can be, some psychopaths can be really hyper intelligent people, and yet they have no sense of the value of humanity. So within that, they can quite easily, if they see that a human being is a threat to them, killing them is nothing, because it doesn't mean anything. That it's just like you know, us treading on a twig that's in our path.
Yeah, we see those rise to political power all the time.
I agree with you there.
Don't we all? Unfortunately, they don't take the hint, do they?
No, they're not. It's sort of a self-correcting system in that leadership like that does not seem to self-sustain, and so they have to consume everything around them. And
yes. But you see what I'm trying to make clear. I hope I'm doing that. But that we have to derive all these connections, and as we go along, the story unfolds, and everything you find is connected, and this big quantum addition process is what absolutely astonished me after 30 odd years of looking hard and as neutrally and as unprejudiced as I could be into all the evidence. And that's the biggest battle of all.
Well, the thing is,
how do you discard all the precious things, you know, that you were taught and whatever, and take a fresh look at all of this? But if you can manage to do that, you've got an absolutely glorious fund of new insight in front of you that actually fortifies you to a great deal of, if you like, a future scope of contentment and whatever. However, you might on that discover such a thing that has happened to our Earth, and that really, Brooks, is the thing we ought to talk about. What does this contingent that we've got now present to us all in terms of our future on this planet?
Because you know, when you answer the question of UFOs, you consider the scope, the breadth, the not only in time, but in exposure all around the world to all walks of life, daytime,
indeed,
nighttime. Then you also have to consider the interaction between those UFOs and what we think are the occupants of this planet. And you run smack dab into the concept of abductions, because that's really the interface between the UFOs and us. So how many humans have been abducted? I mean, what's the scope of this phenomenon?
Absolutely. I think it is far greater than even has been declared, and that is pervasive enough. When we look at all the stories and so on, you've got two heroes in my mind in America. They're Professor Jacobs and Bud Hopkins, doing valiant research into these things, and of course they have been derided, and many people dismiss them and so on. And I tell you what, in terms of this meeting that you had at your press club in Washington recently, I tell you, people will have to wake up and take notice now. If there's any sense at all of meaning in all of this, I think the world has to wake up somehow, because somewhere in this planet of ours there is a huge cartel covering up this kind of mechanism that has existed on this earth, I believe, for well over 200 millennia.
And we'll talk about the cover up. That's part of the fun part. But
we shouldn't forget the late
Professor John Mack as well, who also did great research. He actually invited me to join him on interviewing these abductees at one point, although it never actually
And of course, he never made it. He's gone, you know.
Yeah.
And here's an influential and very, very eminent mind. And that's really something that we all have to look to. What on earth is going on? And, of course, if you've got children, it is something that every parent would have to look at. And I don't really want to start up with any kind of conspiracy theory and all the rest of it. I really don't like to walk the path of everyone's prejudice and subjective opinions and so on. You know, I've been trained too much in science to do that. But I think I'm sufficiently out of the box not to be constrained by that.
Yeah, and it's a well-trained prejudice, too. I mean, it's not as though there hasn't been a tremendous amount of disinformation, not only from the government, like, oh, you don't believe in UFOs, do you? But also inside the New Age community, there have been disinformation people really taking things to extreme, feeding sci-fi.
Well, that's the problem, is it not? That when you are frustrated, and when you have, you know, New Age people, I have a kind of sympathy for them, but I really go no distance with them at all in some of the kinds of things they say. However, they do tend to be a nicer kind of person that has some sense of you know, protection to themselves and people and whatever. However, the problem with that is, of course, good nature sometimes forbids good outlook. And
well, there's also...
One has to be rather stern in the way one looks at things and works things out and so on, because it's no help to anyone to kind of sing psalms when all around you is burning, you know, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Sure, and there's also...
I'm not saying that New Age people necessarily do that, but I think a lot of them do, and they have a reputation based on that, I think.
Well, there's also, for some reason, and I don't really know why it is, there's an overriding theme of profiteering, too. It's not as though they're just doing a public service. They're in it to make money.
But that's the way of the world. You know, as the old man of Jerusalem, as I call Jesus Christ, said, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and suffers the loss of his soul?
Sure.
And we are talking of a mechanism for continuity, and that is the most important thing, I think, that we can talk about. Do we have such a thing? Is it a pipe dream? Is it some kind of, you know, strange thing dreamt up by people because they want to feel secure and see something exists past death and so on? And I think that in my own researches, whilst not at the start believing in anything past death, I have to say I'm an absolute convert to the fact that, I would say, as far as I could be certain of anything, I am certain that we continue past this life into something else and then come back. Now, what that might be is a speculation, and has to be, obviously, but the fact is that I am absolutely true-derived, and as 1 + 1 =... Not 2, but 1 + 1. You see what I hope you see what I'm trying to say. I think a lot of mathematicians will have a big, big argument about this, but many of them will agree with me. 1 + 1 = 1 + 1, not 2.
That's right. Well, it's 1 squared anyway. So when we talk about the scope of this issue of abduction and study and genetic research or genetic manipulation, do the Greys bring everyone back, or are there some that just don't return to their natural habitat? They just disappear off the face of the earth. I mean, are we talking about an assault on the sovereignty of the human race that stretches over millennia? And if we are, is not that the exact threat that governments are formed to protect us against?
Yes. Well, that's the whole point. And do governments know this? And when we say governments, do we mean people that we normally take to rule us? Or is there something else? Governments within the government that is so powerful all over the world that, in fact, they have some kind of, shall we say, attachment to this principle we call the Greys or whatever it is. To answer your question, well, who knows? But we can take educated guesses, and I hope those guesses are contrived based upon something logical and hitches up together and not some fancy kind of want, subjective want, and this way or that, so to speak. Mm. And that's what we're crying out for. Let's please try to look at this thing with as pristine a logical line of derivation as possible. because there is so much at stake. And if we go into this, and this is where your disinformation business comes in, there may be beings, plants, or whatever it out there, that come in and feed deliberate disinformation, and then, of course, puts everybody off scale, so to speak. But now they are starting at least to acknowledge that there is a presence here with this press club thing. There are some eminent people who for so long have been insulted, their integrity maligned and so forth, and they are coming online now. People are going to tumble into this and force this issue. And maybe, and this is what the change that's coming is all about, that this, whatever they talk about, you know, they have this business about 2012 and all the rest of it. I really don't see there's a problem there. I think there may be a change in how we as human beings see ourselves as human beings, and as a quantum in the world context, we change, if you like, the way we look at things and the way we assemble things and so forth. The most dangerous thing, of course, would be the actual making man walk as a machine. And these things that are here with their huge intelligences are machines. So we've got to guard against any paradigms that are set up that want to make us follow in that same kind of way.
I was just going to say, talking about governments and their, what you could see as their role in that they're supposed to be there to protect us from this type of thing. It's interesting. I did a search on this recent press conference that was being made about these pilots who have witnessed these things sort of present in nuclear bases and so on. And I found that there was a lot of coverage on it on the India Defense website of the national government website of India, that they were covering the fact that this was being presented in the States about so many witnesses that these that there seemed to be UFO interest in these nuclear weapons and how they were trying to do things to these. So perhaps there are at least some governments that are taking this seriously.
Well, I know 10 years ago, actually in May of 2001, there was a similar press conference. It really took the world by storm. I watched it. My jaw was on the floor. I said, holy cow, this is disclosure. It's going to happen. Everything is going to break loose. Stephen Greer's done it. And then
don't believe it.
ten years went by, and nothing.
They'll still get away with this, I'll tell you.
Oh, my goodness. So it's been 10 years since a major press conference.
Absolutely.
Like,
but I think the momentum's building, and maybe that's wishful thinking, but I tell you, if you look at all the signs, I think there comes a point now where something important has to be said to the world. And I think when we get that message, I think we then have to look at our assets against our liabilities, as we have never done before, never mind all the fiscal problems we have and so forth. This is going to be obviously of primary importance to all living people, beings on this, intelligent or not, people on this on this planet, and you know, I've got professor of biochemistry here with me. It's interesting to have his take on this because it's not normally his subject, but he is a very distinguished chap when it comes to how we put our DNA together, and then he's here just to answer questions that people
I definitely want to get into that in the second hour. Yeah. Let's go ahead and take a quick 3-minute break. This will just be music that'll run, and it will play a Sunday night and let our affiliates do their thing. And we'll come back right after this with more of Nigel Kerner and Diane Silverman. And what's the biochemist's name? We'll get that at the beginning of the hour. His book is Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. Nigel Kerner. We'll be right back after this. Don't go away.
Well, I dreamed I saw the knights in armor come to the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement when the sun burst through the sky. felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship fly in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seas to a new home in the sky.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio Hour 2 with our guest Nigel Kerner. His book is Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, the Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity. And in this hour, I guess we'll get into maybe some of the biochemical DNA tampering that's gone on. Evidence is in the genome, people, Earth explorers. It's not just a rumor and conjecture. The biochemical tape is there, and we're reading it. Welcome back.
Yeah. Well, this we have here in my company, Dr. John Biggerstaff, who works out of Tennessee University. He's one of your captures, you know.
The brain drain, they call it.
And Dr. Andrew Silverman is the other honcho with me here.
All right, I've got it. Got the names written down. I love UT. I graduated from Tennessee Technological University over in Cookeville, Tennessee, not far away. So we love the Tennessee campuses, great schools. All right, so we have before us a plethora of evidence that goes back, you know, to cave drawings and before. But we also have a biochemical record that's been left anthropologically in beings that we have exhumed that have been fairly well preserved. And what we see in the record is that there are sudden and massive changes in the genome which could not have been natural. They had to be manipulated. And that means that other beings have been on this planet capable of doing this kind of work, which is not really a big stretch. We're doing it now between cabbages and jellyfish and human beings and corn. It will be done as we progress in our scientific ability, and it has been done in the past, which is quite stunning. And I'd like to kind of go into that a little bit. What did you find as you began researching this and putting it into this fine publication? Did I lose everybody, or is everybody still there?
Hello?
Yes, I'm still there.
Hello?
Are you hearing me?
Hello?
Oh, boy. I don't know what happened. I've got a signal going, and is it going out? Are you hearing me?
Well, we can't tell you. You're not receiving us. Hello?
I can hear you.
All right, great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
All right. Well, that's the wonder of live internet radio. You never know what's going to happen. Sometimes the internet does its own thing. We have in the record, in the genomic record, evidence of tampering. And at least it's reasonable to assume that that tampering never stopped. Has the game changed at all? Are they still about the same program they were 200,000 years ago? Are they doing something different than they were 50 years ago? Oh, boy. For some reason, they're not hearing me. I don't know what happened.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I'm asking a question, but nobody's responding, so I didn't know if you were hearing me or not.
Yeah, my interest in all of this as a biologist came when I read Nigel's first book and he started mentioning some of this purported evidence for genetic manipulation, etc. And what I'd like to do is really go through from his thesis, really, of what human beings are. And really he's alluded to or explained really that consciousness, what is us, is really a gradually devolving effect throughout the chaotic milieu as it progresses towards the other pole of existence, if you like. And thus we are as human beings, and our sentience is really from the origin itself. Now, during some of this time, as we become more and more, you know, as we devolve, we need essentially prosthetics for functions which we would have originally been able to do, such as communicate with each other, etc., through, you know, more symmetrical resonance fields. As things get more chaotic, we need to invent technologies to be able to replace those functions. Now, obviously, the end conclusion of this is that we're going to make artificial intelligences, but we're going to make those out of atoms themselves. And so they have no reference frame really back to the origin of this. But seeing that we can, for instance, we can come back again and we still retain our original integrity to be able to move into atoms and actually continue our lives, really, I mean, this is a for them, it's an incredibly enticing function, even though the principle is beyond their fundamental understanding, since they are just made of atoms. And so, really what they do is, in Nigel's thesis, what they've done is to taken people, if you like, or hominids, which have devolved down to the state where effectively their soul, if you like, as Nigel called it, really is capturable in a sense. But in order for them to actually progress their existence, the thesis is that really they've got to try and piggyback onto us and manipulate us so that we're more like them in some ways, so effectively they can continue their existence using the same mechanism that we use.
So they're turning us more into a machine.
That's right.
And them more into living things.
Absolutely.
Have you noticed how much the world is becoming much more systemic and machine-like, even in terms of what they ask us as human beings to be, if you see what I'm trying to say?
Sure.
And there's a huge change that's going towards this all the time.
So,
and no one notices it, you see. This is the problem, Brooks. We all take it as the day's own troubles as we go along, and our own sweet way, you know, interested in all the things that we as human beings have to cope with. And little by little, the changes are coming in that make us actually lose the component of us that makes us something very special and actually have a way of gaining an eternal scale of reference. They, by interposing their kind of mechanism on us, as Dr. Bickerstaff will tell you, they then interfere with this. And this is the great thing. They, I believe, are taking away the possibility for some of us to have an eternal scale of existence. And that is probably the biggest thing that we can lose.
Now, one of the points here is that it takes if we do genetic experiments, for instance, we have to wait for generations of animals or fish or bacteria to actually pass. If they're going to mess with human beings, they've got to effectively adjust or take into account the relative lifespan to see whether or not these genetic changes are going to generate any aberrant effects, or whether they're actually going to run true to what it is the intention of the greys is to actually be able to hijack and piggyback onto our DNA. And I think what originally happened and what Nigel is hypothesizing is that from the sort of out of Africa experience, you know, I mean, there really is an argument for, I mean, Africa at that time was in fact a very nice place to live, and why really sort of all wander off in different directions. But if one were setting up an experiment as a scientist, for instance, one might genetically manipulate a population, take groups of individuals, put them in different places and culture them like we do bacteria, etc., so that you can actually see what those effects are and which of these populations is actually going to generate the qualities that you actually want to propagate, to actually hijack and piggyback onto. And I think perhaps, you know, these abductions, etc., maybe just in some ways that they're actually picking up people, having a look at them to see whether or not these human beings are actually conforming to their program, or even to try and find out where people are not conforming. And Nigel is postulating that may be more the case. Why are they not conforming, and are they, you know, relevant to the continued experiment, or shall they move on to another part of the population? I think the other part of this is, in terms of this piggyback experience, that what these aliens are doing is, in fact, now more and more actually genetically intercepting human beings, so that their progeny, the babies — there are lots of reports of people being presented with their babies to look at the maternal effect, etc. But really, you know, I think they're trying to get closer and closer to where they can actually put their hybrids, if you like, within our own population. And I think quite a few people have actually postulated that in the past.
Yeah, I don't doubt that there are probably hybrids walking among us. Sometimes you see them at the mall. It's not that difficult to believe.
The problem with that is we all have our subjective view of what a hybrid should be.
Yeah.
And sometimes we include our family in there, don't we?
Or ourselves. In historical Earth, when the population of man was very light and there were Neanderthals and Cro-Mags on the Earth, it was easy to isolate populations. You could pick up a couple hundred souls. You could manipulate their offspring, make sure that they were mature, and then drop them into a fairly isolated place. We didn't have trains. We didn't travel. We stayed pretty much in the climes where we grew up and died. And
that's the interesting thing, you see, Brooke, is why did the population from this wonderful benign climate in Africa be suddenly transported to northern climes? Why were they taken there? Now, there's something, a clue to this in the book I try to offer as an explanation, because top geneticists cannot understand why we go into a stressful situation from a situation where everything was much easier to, in fact, promulgate life, living, and the pursuit of whatever contentment they were capable of getting at the time. And so this is the problem, is why were we isolated and put in different parts of the world? I think it's part of a genetic experiment they were doing, because there were certain types of hominid they, for physical reasons, their technology couldn't actually change. And they only chose a derivational type of hominid which they could do this to. If that's the case, then they have a favored type of hominid they're using. There's an example that sent a chill through me when I read it, because obviously, I mean, I was only born at the end of the war, so to speak, but This German dictator Hitler was supposed to have presented to his cartel of devils, whatever you might call these things, the new man. And there it was, this kind of artifact human being that he said was going to be the future man. And it is a crazy situation, but many of this type of man is described by abductees and people who've had you know, experience of these encounters with these greys as being within the kind of disposition of their ships or whatever it is that they use to move around in and so on. And the same type of man, the same features and so on. And I think that this kind of business is being perfected, you know, to the point where none of us will be able to tell the difference. Because if we can, you know how sensitive human beings are, you know, the slightest change of skin tone, and we are suspicious of people. It'll be the size of noses next or whatever, and we will notice it, if you see what I mean. We're all kind of engendered on the human face and features, so they would have to get in something that is possible and something that is attractive to us all. And so therefore, you know, it's easy to be paranoid about this and can construct all kinds of paradigms. I know that. But, you know, we really have to be able to get to terms with this, because one thing is absolutely certain from my point of view through my research, and that is that they're here. They got here past the Einsteinian ceiling speed business. They have the most amazing capacities as described by experienced people. You know, they've been seen doing almost 90-degree turns at 25,000 miles an hour, whatever. They have a prodigious technology. Now, I tell you what, if anyone has a greater technology than anyone else, what happens is you start to dominate. And in the scenario of the second law of thermodynamics, things get worse, not better. So there must be something about us that we can use to continue. And I think that we have that because we don't die, we come back again. Reincarnation was accepted by every single religion in the world at one point. And for various reasons, usually reasons based upon the power of a small cartel of people within each systemic, you know, arrangement of religion, and that these people then went there and said, look, we give you the power by waving our arms or throwing water on you or whatever to go into heaven and that kind of nonsense. Well, I tell you what, maybe they, without realizing, were acting under the instigation of something that was selecting all the time.
Yes,
what about what about the rest of us who have this capacity for eternal life?
The idea that we have eternal life, I think, is irrefutable. It goes through every bit of writing, every bit of song, every bit of thinking that we have. And the ability to literally transcend prison, war, slavery, everything, with that ability to come back over and over again eternally if we wish.
The problem is that we come back to diminishing returns, you see. The earth, as we come back, the disposition is always worse going forward in time. That's the problem. We have to try, it seems to me, to gain a scale that's beyond the return into physical universes of diminishing returns.
Well,
where
I would
thermodynamics works.
But I understand that.
The Godverse is what I'm trying to say.
I understand that, but you have to understand, or at least I try to understand, that the soul is actually gaining experience with each one of these incarnations, and if they can just remember that experience and bring that wisdom forward with them, then true, the physical or this part devolves, but the actual soul might become even more powerful and more benevolent and more wise.
You bet. You're absolutely right. But just think about this. As long as you've got control to see who I am and make decisions freely with free will, that's fine. How about a situation where a contrived creature can put in you, and I wrote an article time ago called Sim Card Man, where they install in you some kind of device that prevents you doing this, where you do not know yourself anymore, as a kind of derivational scope towards matching their prescriptions of being, so to speak. If you can take away from a human being that capacity, we are in big trouble. So we come back, shall we say, after death, to a world where this is the norm. We have no way around this.
Why don't we choose another world to reincarnate on? If this one
that's quite right. We might do, but the fact that we reincarnate or whatever it is based upon, I think, an attachment to things undone. And I think if you've got a harmonic, finally, that harmonic must be met in every kind of prescription possible. And the problem with that is that if you can't meet the harmonic, you are stuck. And that's the problem. They call it karma in the old Indian types of philosophy and so forth. It's a very profound, and if people want to read about it, it's a very profound and very, very clever way of looking at things.
We're just a naturally non-conformant intelligence. You know, our consciousness gets involved in our genes making the proteins that support the human body. And maybe we would resist any kind of conforming biological or even electrobiological way of controlling the human soul. The human soul will transcend that.
And well, ask the doctor if that might be possible.
Hi, Andrew Silverman here. I was just going to say, if we place this into universal context, And if you look at the history of the universe, it began in a state that was altogether a singularity. If Schrödinger was right, that our natural status as sentient beings is all one, and yet we've become separate. Now, how does that follow in terms of the second law of thermodynamics? And logic and reason suggests that the more you separate, the more you restrict, the more you divide, ignorance begets ignorance, that actually you get a vicious circle beginning, that the less you know, the less you understand, the more you fear, the more you separate, the more you become stuck in this idea of self and ego and so on. It becomes a vicious circle, and each time, rather than becoming wiser, we're more likely to become more ignorant. Now, if the universe is ending in a heat death, then if we're sticking around in this physical universe, perhaps there's another way. And this is where, if we're talking about science and scientific evidence, I'm absolutely fascinated by a particular object that exists, which is actually one of the objects in the world that has been studied the most in all of human history, and that's something called the Turin Shroud. Now, many listeners might think, "Oh yes, well of course that was shown 20 years ago to be a fake," but actually, there's been some wonderful work that was done by, for example, Benford and Marino, in their work that showed that the carbon dating was actually done on a part of the cloth that was sewn in later by the nun. So we'll come to this later in the last hour of the program. But there's a lot of evidence, if you look at this cloth, that suggests that humankind has a capacity to actually escape beyond this physical universe to an eternal existence, but that if we stay within it, that we will tend to become...
Try not to be religious about this. I mean, we've had long discussions, my colleagues and I, over this, and come to a kind of understanding about this that we think we can hitch up logically. Dr. Bickerstaff will probably take you through to answer directly how they might do this. But your question was, can we resist this kind of mechanistic input with the power of our spirits and our soul? Of course, it may not be able to influence intrinsically that capacity within us. But what it can do is actually stop it making progress, because while it is inserted, while, shall we say, a SIM card might be inserted into us with a needle or whatever it is, through some system that they might contrive, shall we say, you can't go to hospital unless you get this, that, or the other. You they make laws or whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, that
they do with farm animals now. Society. It won't be
we
long.
Have a big problem. Yeah, sorry, we have a big problem here because we have to follow, you know, what our governments tell us. And supposing that such a thing, such a proposition does take shape, we then have a problem about how do we control us, me, if you like, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, sure.
How
yeah.
do we resist this? And that's the big problem I'm worried about, that maybe these things have such an influence over a small cartel of very powerful people who make the running within our societies, and then you and me and our children become victims of something that is absolutely draconian. And if you really want to know how they can do this, we've been discussing how this with Dr. Bickerstaff, who is a biochemist and so on. Maybe he's got some interesting idea on this.
Yeah, I think in order to understand how they are going to actually hijack and actually influence the way we think, we need to just add a few more facts, really, to define. We've gone through the principle of what really our continuing part is. We know that can interact with atoms in order to work with karmic effects, etc. The big problem is, well, how does it do it? And really, some pioneering work has been done by one of Penrose's colleagues, Stuart Hameroff, in Arizona State, where he was really examining sort of what is consciousness, etc. And really one of the conclusions that they've come up with is really that there is some sort of effective quantum field, if you like, which we can analogize to this soul concept, which is able to interact with the atomic frame through little structures in our cells called microtubules. And what they postulate is that you get this interaction which generates effectively some coherent effect which interacts with really our body water. And, you know, a lot of our biochemistry, we really consider the balls and sticks of molecules that actually interact with each other. And we pay little heed to the solvent that these molecules are actually in. And water is quite a profound substance in many ways. And what they found is that this effect from essentially one side of the atom, if you like, to the other, can be propagated into really structured holographic electrical potentials or electric fields. And it's really those which are switching on and off the DNA in our bodies, etc. It's really being driven by one's consciousness itself through into the atomic system. And really when you come to that idea, rather than the sort of evolutionary paradigm that the genes are actually controlling everything. In fact, again, if one looks at recent articles where one tries to correlate a genetic effect to, for instance, disease or a propensity towards behavioral anomalies, we have a real problem because there's only about a 10% correlation. And this really supports the idea that really the genes are effector systems of some master system which is actually controlling them. Now, once one has such an idea, and there are quite a lot of publications that one can use to defend such an idea as that, and I'm an adherent of such an idea, what actually happened sort of back in the day to try and, I mean, obviously, one's consciousness can control one's physical system, so how do you intercept such a thing? And really, one concept here is that we look to, you know, another structure within the cell called the mitochondrion, the actual powerhouse. And this powerhouse sort of endosymbiotically attached to us many millions ago, years ago. But the problem with this is that if we have, in fact, something which is according to the second law of thermodynamics, then one can't really evolve from a puddle through a set of molecules with some electric bolts to actually generate enough of this effect to get this spontaneous order occurring. And so Nigel's hypothesis in his book is that we have this devolving structure. Well, if we have devolving structures of thought mixed with the atomic process, really how do you get the mitochondria in the first place to put it? You'd have to get something to actually put them in you rather than this endosymbiotic function. And so Nigel's postulate here really, and again I would agree with this, is that, you know, this would be an absolutely wonderful way of putting extra genetic material and energy transfer systems, electron transfer systems, into the cell. Now, since we've got an electrical system there already, if you like, in terms of this holographic electric field, which even Pribram has postulated as the way our brain works, etc. So again, there's quite a lot of evidence for this. If you start putting extra systems in there, which, you know, if one looks at the membrane potential of a mitochondrion, it can be over 100 millivolts, which is actually far higher than the cell membrane potential itself, then these electric fields are going to be disrupted. And so what we're finding more and more now is it's not so much the primary genetic code, the primary sequence of our DNA, which is important. Of course, it is important for the making the sequences of the proteins. But in fact, that more things like psychological qualities, all of these different, than the ways in which different genes are switched on and switched off, is more controlled from the conformation, the three-dimensional structure of that DNA. And in fact, I actually work on some parts of this myself. So really changing the conformation or the super coiled twisting of DNA can actually be very important there. But since that super coiling and twisting through our psychological qualities is controlled by an electrical paradigm from a quantum paradigm, if you like, then to interrupt that with things like mitochondria, which has its own DNA, one can clearly see that if one can manipulate the DNA of the mitochondria, then we can actually affect psychological profiles and genetic effects that are going to come from that.
And that's a wonderful way of getting into the nuclear DNA through this bacterium, you see,
sure.
that had to the mitochondria within bacterium, and that really is the key to all of this. I think this is how they started to alter species anyway in the first place. In other words, to create the larger brain and, commensurate with that, to actually create a pelvis that was able to admit the larger brain in African Eve and create the hominids we know as Homo sapiens sapiens in the first place. So, you see, these guys have a trick or two based upon their technological deductive thinkability, so to speak, you know, and really we have a big deal here. They can come past all the axiomatic forbiddances like the speed of light problem and so on and to this planet. And if they can come and do that, I tell you what, Brooks, they can control anything. They can switch off our nuclear security codes, whatever it is. We are in big trouble.
Well,
and that's why
I found
Trump and Stone admit they're here, because they can't protect us. And that's a big deal. And I think the people of a great sense of veracity, you know, colonels and captains in the American services and so on, are really worried about this. These people have children. We have generations to come. We are just the, in a sense, we're not royalty, whatever. We're just the ordinary citizens of being, so to speak.
Well, if we become aware of this, and I would say that nation by nation, even village by village, we are becoming aware of it.
And programs like yours are actually doing a fantastic service, if I may compliment you, in at least trying to get this into the mainstream.
Right, yeah.
So when so many people run away from this, you know, within the mainstream, why is that? Now, that's a big question we've got to ask.
I'm not really sure why that is. Now, I have to tell you, I've watched shows like Larry King and I watch Fox News, and I got to tell you, about every 4, 5, 6 days, there's a pretty big piece on UFOs and the idea that we might be visited by other worlds. I'm sure History Channel, Discovery Channel, Science Channel has all kinds of documentaries on it. I think that generally...
So carefully examine them, and you will find a underlying sense of humor there.
Sure.
There's a kind of...
Mockery.
A skeptic nonsense put in there, whatever.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen a program where people who can understand and done research into this have got together and actually presented their case?
Not in the mainstream. I mean, I've seen it at various conferences.
You will not get it there, really.
But, you know, I found a perfect statement of purpose in the book. It says, the whole gray manifest is a search for the accomplishing of a means to a natural living process rather than continually manufacturing one as they have. They want a soul. Well, you know, they can't have one. And
your finger on it.
They could suppress ours. But
you have a wonderful mind, if I may compliment you on it, because that's a wonderful piece of perception there. And that's the thing that is the final paradox of all. Because as a machine, they will just go by the program.
Right.
I have no sense of acrimony towards these greys whatsoever. They are just simply doing what they're programmed to do.
Yes, exactly.
The big problem was you made a mistake making them in the first place like this. That's the big problem.
Well,
are guessing the bad side of it all. You see?
You know, I'm an engineer, so I'm always looking for solutions. And one of the yeah. things that is a quandary for us is they may be here, or they are here, maybe by the hundreds of thousands, maybe by the millions.
Yes.
Where are they? How do we round them up and ship them out?
Well, I read from your particular brief that you went looking for them somewhere, and you were heading in the right direction. I believe they have to hide within, you know, parts of the world that we don't normally go to. There was a recent thing, a ship off the coast of New Zealand was sailing its way through a rather large ship from all accounts, and this massive great wave began to form in front of it, and out of that wave came a huge ship or whatever this thing was and took off in front of all these people. And of course no one would believe the crew when they got back and said this is what they saw.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Yes.
You get this jokey kind of situation, you know, in the mainstream, and the vast majority of people are denied the seeing of or the verification of these things. And that's what I'm worried about. What lies beyond this consensus in the mainstream?
Well, if you look at the way that money is being spent in and let's just look at particularly military. NASA's budget has continuously been shrunk. I think this year it was like $600 million. It's really ridiculous. But the national defense budget for the same year was $1.3 trillion.
Yes.
And, you know, my question is, you know, the uniformed soldier fighting U.S. Armies, for instance, is a relic. It doesn't exist anymore. Yes. We are the dominant force in humanity on the planet. And hopefully we're a force for good, but that could be argued later.
Yes.
The question is, look at the weaponry. Look at the detection systems. Almost every other day, we are launching special satellites into space with the surveillance ability of looking at the Earth. Just Sunday, I talked about a bill that was in the House that would not allow the Pentagon access to imagery from satellites with sharper apertures than 1.5 meters. And we're launching satellites with sharper apertures all the way down to 1 meter, even less.
Yeah.
So if we're keeping that information from the Pentagon, who is getting that information?
You bet. What? That's the big $64,000 question.
Yeah, we are.
Who is powerful enough to do this?
Exactly.
And how powerful are they that they can contrive the keeping of evidence of this pervasive phenomenon that many hundreds of thousands of people are seeing and capturing with their video cameras and so on? You can just poo-poo anything that comes on a video camera and say it's been created in the studio. Short of getting these guys into a situation where they are verified by the President of the United States, China, or Soviet Union, and actually talking to the world and saying, here is Mr. Alien. There is no way you can get physical evidence out to the public. All you have to do is control the media, and the media can be easily controlled by black budgets all over the world.
Sure.
There's no question about that. So you and I, all that's left is this marvelous internet. But you asked a very important question that I'd like to get back to, if I may, because it really points in the direction of some kind of redemptiveness. Although I wasn't looking for it, I happened on it, and I saw this quite simply. And that comes from something that happened 2,000 years ago. Now, please understand me, Brooks. I have no sense of religion whatsoever. I simply hope I have a sense for the truth. And inasmuch as this is so, you asked a very important question. I think we kind of walked over all of this with it. We're trying to explain these things to you. But in fact, you ask a very important question. How do we resist this kind of tirade if it comes from a technology as great as this? Well, I believe that something happened 2,000 years ago. And remember, I am not a religious person when I see this. But looking at the evidence of the contrary to the grey phenomenon, so to speak, I began to realize that something that happened 2,000 years ago may in fact have the antidote to all of this. And Dr. Silverman, who is Jewish, will be able to explain this to you. And he has no reason to do this, by the way. He's not a Christian.
That's all right.
It's to do with with this chap we call Jesus Christ, or Jeshua ben Yosef, to give him his real name.
HaMashiach.
Yeah, so he'll bring him. He'll explain something about this artifact that he left, called the Shroud of Turin. And in this, if you bear with us, is an incredible procedure and process that might point to what you and I and each one of us may have in potential to resist these greys. So,
yeah, I alluded to earlier about this, the Turin Shroud, and this is for. I just have to give a brief introduction about it for those of your listeners who don't know much about it. It's a 14-foot long piece of cloth that has an image on it of a man. That has been known to where its whereabouts, at least for the past 700 years, and there's a lot of evidence to point to its whereabouts way beyond that, going back two millennia. Now, something very interesting happened back in 1898 when photography was first discovered, and someone called Secondo Pia took a photograph of the shroud, and when he saw the photographic negative of the shroud, he nearly fainted because the photographic negative was a perfect positive. The shroud itself the image on there is a photographic negative. And it caused quite a stir at the time, and people thought this was a forgery, that his picture of it was a forgery, until in the 1930s it was photographed again, and of course the same thing was found. And scientists have studied this cloth, and I just want to get out of the way first of all, because a lot of people will be thinking about this carbon dating of 1988 and so on. Now, the thing about this is that it's been shown by careful study by textile experts and by a very world-renowned chemist who produced a paper in Thermochimica Acta, it's called, that actually showed that the part of the cloth that was dated in the carbon dating was actually a part of the cloth that was sewn in. It was a mixture of interweaving of a part of the cloth that was sewn in later by the nuns in the 16th century. And it was actually a combination of 16th century and 1st century cloth that was dated, hence the 14th century date.
Wow.
Now, and people can look this up for themselves. A wonderful research was initially done on this by Benford and Marino and Raymond Rogers, who was the chemist who was one of the original people in what was called the STIRP group, the Shroud of Turin Research Project, who once, originally when he heard the carbon dating, he was very angry when anyone tried to contradict it, because he was a man of science through and through. And he when he heard that there was an interweaving of part of the cloth that was added in later, he said, right, I'm going to prove them wrong very easily. And in trying to prove them wrong, he ended up proving them right. And before he died, he gave this interview saying that, you know, I wanted to disprove this, but they're absolutely right. The part that was dated was a much more recent cloth, and many scientists want more tests to be done, but unfortunately the Vatican aren't willing to release the samples for it to be done. But if we get back to the image on the shroud, now, it's only a surface phenomenon on the surface fibers of the cloth, no pigment involved. The only thing that's actually added to the cloth that forms part of the image has been shown to actually be human blood of a human male, blood group AB, and that's what makes the blood stains on there. But the actual image of the cloth that shows in perfect anatomical detail the front and the back of the man, it was wrapped around the front and the back of a man who forensic pathologists have looked at the image and have shown that this particular individual with a Semitic appearance, he had been crucified, he had been whipped. And you can find all the details of all of everything that was done to him, the crown of thorns and the nails through the wrist, they're all there. Everything that points to this having been fitting with the specific historical characteristics that we associate with the historical character of Jesus. And botanists have looked at the cloth and found evidence from the pollen on it that it must have been in Jerusalem, in Judea, in the first century around March, April time, to have formed the patterns that it has on there. Now, this is a surface phenomenon, as I say, and the only consistent idea that the scientists who have studied it, and I recently went to and gave a talk at one of the international symposiums that have been held on the shroud. The one idea that they have behind how the image could have got there is there was a short, intense burst of radiant energy that came from the body of the man, the dead body of the man that was wrapped in the shroud, such that the surface image, which is less than a micron in thickness, actually contains distance-coded holographic information. It's the only photograph in existence, that light photograph, that has this capacity. And we can't replicate it, even with 21st century technology. We don't know how to make such a thing now. And what this suggests, and further studies on it have suggested, that actually when the image was formed, the body of the man was actually upright. He was actually vertical and suspended in the air, because the image of the hair is actually hanging down on the shoulders rather than behind, and the back of the body isn't compressed against the stone slab like it should have been if he was lying flat. What this suggests is that this dead body actually rose up from the slab where it was and actually shone brighter than the sun for a fraction of a nanosecond. And the only way you can actually make a similar change to linen that has been shown has been reproduced is using, they've done it with ultraviolet lasers. But that's just to make a spot on a cloth. You can't, to make the whole image, it would have to have been like laser light that was shining from his whole body. It had to have been from his body rather than reflected from his body to account for the distance coded effect. So the subject of my talk at this conference was, how did that happen? How does a dead body shine brighter than the sun? And Is it just coincidence that there's so much evidence suggesting that the person who this phenomenon happened to be the one individual throughout the history of man who has had the most impact historically in suggesting a way of life that is congruent with going against what we're describing in terms of the entropic drift that separates? When he said, love thy neighbor as thyself, as Schrödinger himself pointed out, our neighbor is ourself. So we actually come from a singularity where we were all one, and yet our what people call sin, as Nigel points out, is simply restriction. It's simply us being less than we can be, and being less than we can be makes us different from each other because we each have our own individual patterns of being less than we can be, and that's what makes individuality, that's what fosters separation and selfishness and so on. And these great teachers like the Buddha and Jesus and so on, they have always said is that all we need to do is to do the opposite of what the universe is doing. We have to bind together. We have
swim
to
upstream, as it were. And I like the idea, and I do. I have a good friend, William Henry, who also talks about Jesus becoming the light body. And this tremendous burst of energy is the transformation, the ascension of...
Mm-hmm. of the essential thing, though, if I may just interpose here, the essential thing is that through his words, if you can catalogue them as they're available, through his words, every single human being has the capacity to do this. And if we have the capacity to unscrew the hydrogen bonds in us and glow brighter than the sun, so to speak, we are something absolutely marvelous. And I can see why a machine can recognize this capacity.
Right, but it's never going to be able to master it. I mean, it might be able to suppress
the body.
That's right,
you're right. They will not do that. You're quite right. They will not be able to master because they won't understand it, but they will be curious enough to try to seek it through their program.
And as Nigel points out, this story in the Gospels that Jesus was taken to a high point where he saw all the cities of the earth. You can do an experiment. The listeners can do this if they have a globe. Turn it round and you'll see that if you point it in a certain direction from one particular perspective, you can see virtually the whole of the landmass of what used to be Gondwanaland, if you like, Eurasia, Africa, the Americas, Australasia, can all be witnessed. And if you turn it around 180 degrees, then you see the Pacific. And where is the center of all of that landmass?
Egypt.
Well, it's not far from Judea. So if you go up in a straight line from there, from where Jesus was, that's where you can see the cities of the world from space.
And so therefore you imply from that Jesus Christ was probably taken by one of these things on the earth. And remember, it's reported to have said that he would give Jesus custody of the whole earth. The implication, of course, was that they owned the whole earth if he fell down and worshipped him. And in another statement he said, you know, an incredible thing, you know, Jesus replied in a retort to him, get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, you shall not tempt the Son of Man. I think he was putting that machine being in its place and telling it that it was a machine. And as a machine, it was less than an insect.
No, interesting, if you look at the mythology surrounding this character, Satan or Shaitan, or called various different things in different cultures, but it's basically referred to as a creature that fell from the sky. Now, what is that? How can you have an opposite of God? If an opposite of God, there's no such thing, obviously, logically, as an opposite of God, but if as close to that as you can imagine, it's not going to be a sentient being, because to be sentient, if we're saying that sentience derived from this original state that we all came from of being all together and one, then it would have to be God to be sentient.
Absolutely.
So it fits much more, as Nigel suggests, that this was actually just a mechanical pseudo-intelligence. Yeah. What we call artificial intelligence is pseudo-intelligence because it has no sentience, it has no mind or awareness.
And that is our great triumph, that we have this over that entity with all its technological superiority and so forth. It itself doesn't know that it is that. And I was rather curious as to why Jesus was not killed, or why he wasn't disposed of, if you like, talking like this to a person who claimed he had custody of the entire globe. Mm. And I think it's because a machine doesn't have a sense of revenge or vanity or whatever, that it was information to this being, that it was what it was. That was the status. And somehow, this individual, Yeshua ben Yosef, was able to communicate its own status in terms of an evolutionary paradigm. And so, because it was information, he was returned back. Mm-hmm. I don't know what might have happened to the individual he spoke to, whether he was called Satan or what, I don't know. But the fact is that that situation provided for me an insight into what the Greys might be. They simply are machines doing their business through a program. And because that is so, in one sense, they're extremely dangerous, and in another sense, we are superior to them. And the real business is, how do we convince all of us, the whole family of man, of the size of our nature and our property of being, so to speak? Now, I don't want to sound like some preacher or a teacher of new meanings. I really don't know what on earth that means. But, you know, in doing the research into all this business, these are the conclusions I came to. This verification, quite simply, Brooks, that we are something fantastic. And that would explain why a superior technology would persist on this planet for the length of time it has, to be able to acquire perhaps some of the propensities that we as beings have. Otherwise, I can't understand why something as superior as this in technology would spend 5 nanoseconds.
Well, that's true. I mean, we although we are conscious beings, many of us, most of us, are not conscious that we're conscious.
Absolutely.
And, you know, we're in writing these books and speaking about this the way that we do on the air to get other people to listen, are trying to awaken those who are not conscious that they're conscious, so that they can realize that they are sovereign beings, eternal beings having a mortal experience.
As Jesus himself said, is it not written, you are gods? He was pointing to the immense limitless potential of any and all human being.
Naturally derived living being. That's the most crucial difference.
We are
naturally derived living being from the Big Bang. We have a connection to the very start of it all. And that's what makes us extraordinarily special. And anyone out there in the universe, too, extraordinarily special if they've come through in this kind of fashion. And that's something we really need to remember, Brooks. And if you like, the whole story of this business of mine, you know, in writing these books and so on, is quite simply to tell, in great kind of surprise, really, what I have discovered. The size of our stature and how we as humanity do not really realize that we are something eternally scoped and not something temporarily to be disposed of in cruelty and wickedness and war and all the rest of it. And that is something I think somehow we've got to get to the public out there, and perhaps programs like yours and inventive minds like yours might be able to do.
Okay. Well, we are. There are points of light on the planet now, and we're able to communicate like never before. Yeah, I mean, since 1996, really, we've been able to communicate with one another freely and unfettered as a planet, by and large.
You bet.
And the words of frustration that you quoted of Jesus from John 10:34, when he turned and snapped back at the Pharisees, is it not written, I said unto you, ye are gods, unto whom the gospel is given. He's actually quoting Psalms from their own Old Testament. So they already knew that that existed, and they, in their day, suppressed that information so that they could maintain power over their own political dominion.
Yeah. And so, it's interesting that, in a way, you could see any sort of robotic artificial intelligence as an expert in logic, whereas Jesus was actually an expert in reason, going a bit deeper into it and saying, okay, you can use logic, you can make an atom bomb and so on, but where's it gonna take you? You have to start from the fundamentals of why are you there and what does your existence mean and so on. And interestingly, he actually said, when he was asked, what was he doing here? What was the purpose behind it? And he didn't say, I'm here to start a church, I'm here to start a religion, organization, and so on. He said, quite simply, I'm here to bear witness to the truth. So in a sense, that's how he was actually, in a sense, associated with information in that sense, but in a living sense, and pointing to the size and grandeur of all sentient beings. Yes.
And that's the important message to get through, I think, to us all. And, I mean, I really didn't want to write any books about anything. I was actually doing an article on cricket when my son asked me the question. And it's really rather romantic thing, the way this all derived. And, you know, last thing I wanted to know about was UFOs when I was writing an article on this noble game of cricket. Unfortunately, you Americans don't have any perception of how thoroughly wonderful this game really is, you know. I'm hoping that somehow someone will have some propaganda over there and bring that to you Americans, and then you will be truly civilized, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Oh, my goodness.
However, it bears saying that, you know, America, whatever anyone may say, is the greatest source of inspiration to the world. And in its beauty, it is the grandest place of all. And I'm saying that in terms of a British perspective. And I think anyone with any kind of sense of anything is seeing how our world has been saved by American interventions countless times and so on in the past, that it's something that is something we all have to take recognizance of. However, not so great in the recent past. And so, sadly, I'm hoping that this kind of escape to the derivational scope of the second law of thermodynamics is not taking care of a place that has given so much to the world. And I'm not saying this because you're American or I'm speaking to an American audience. I think maybe that I'm probably more qualified to make the statement than any American is to do that, for obvious reasons. However, I hope they will stop and take a look at the leadership that they can have in the world, where this question of an interception by something out of this world, of the grand scale of power it might have, might be, if you like, in terms of our own sense of each other and so on. This is surely the point, not to hide this fact. It's the point to announce it to the world and say, look, let's get together and see what we can do. If we can understand what our scope might be as simple human beings, and communicate this in some kind of way to these interceptors that might be here who are machines, we may well have a chance in some kind of way of stopping whatever hidden agenda these things might have.
Well said.
And remember, this is the problem. They have an agenda, which I believe is in terms of their own resolutions of whatever thinkability they might have, not ours. We are lab rats, I am utterly convinced, of theirs through their technological inertias and so on.
Well, I think the thing that worries, you know, those of us that look at this question, is that not only do the Greys have an agenda, but we now really believe or suspect that this super government, this government inside governments, also has an agenda. We just need to figure out what it is.
And, yeah, the problem is this. They may well be composed of hybridized being that are acting to the auspices of the Greys. We may be able to draw that conclusion from the fact that they're ignoring what is simple derivational sense about that situation that says, if one of these things comes and has all this great technological power over us, why, and they are benign, why don't they declare it? Why don't they take our entire planet into a great and beautiful future? And by saying, look, here we are, we have all these wonderful senses, knowledge of all these wonderful things in the universe and so on. Join us and let's be a happy throng together. Oh, no, they are hiding.
Yes,
something there is in their hiding that points to something nefarious.
Well, let's see if we can shine a little light on it in our next hour. We'll be back with more X Squared Radio right after this. I felt it fitting we play a little Tchaikovsky here. So we'll be back in about 6 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Nigel Turner and Andrew Silverman. Don't go away. We'll be right back. And welcome back to X Squared Radio. Tchaikovsky, Hymn of the Cherubim. Didn't know Tchaikovsky wrote chorus, but he did, and it's quite inspirational, and I like it. So we played it here on X Squared Radio for you. Very fitting for the subject matter we're talking about. The book is wonderful, and it's Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, The Conspiracy to Genetically Tamper with Humanity, written by Nigel Turner. And we've had the wonderful privilege of having not only Nigel, but Andrew Silverman and Dr. Picklestaff on the program with us tonight. And we're approaching this from several different points of view, because this may be, in fact, I'm convinced it is, the most profound question of humanity since the Earth cooled. We're going to go into this fact of life after life and how it plays into this equation that these supercomputer grays think they have figured out. There might be a built-in flaw in their programming, and we'll see if we can discover it. Welcome back to Hour 3 of X Squared Radio, Nigel. Here we go.
Yeah. Well, if I may say, this continuum that begins, I think, with the Shroud in terms of our current day perspectives of things, is to try to demonstrate to humanity the size of each individual. I keep accenting this. I hope I'm not boring the audience. But, you know, you cannot say this often enough. We really do not realize the capacity we each have for eternal scale of an eternal scale of existence and such.
And why do you think that is? I mean, you have a great quote from Plato in here, and I just want to read it because it's at the beginning of the chapter, The Fact of Life After Life. It says, "A cosmic matrix of rainbow light exists around the Earth. This matrix provides souls with a number of earthly destinies from which to choose. Then, before we are born into the world, we are required to forget these memories. Maybe that's why humanity doesn't realize the great scope of their existence."
Yes. Well, Mr. Plato knew a thing or two, but at the same time, the problem with doing that is that when you forget your size and your potential grandness and beauty, you do that because if you remember it, you would do nothing. In a world of decay and diminishing returns governed by the second law of thermodynamics, it is easy to see contradictions to all of this. So it's best, I think, in overall, to have a clean slate in which you can act out whatever the propensities that are retained within what I call a morphogenic electrospatial field. It sounds an absolutely contrived description, but I was looking at some way of describing what I call a soul, a information line that is derived through the time that each individual has existed, where all information is extrapolated and preserved, and that this then comes to each of us, and as we go and gain more and more experience within worlds of diminishing returns, all we have is that inner prompt from these memories that keeps us in some kind of situation that is able to increase that and undo the restrictions that keep us trapped within physical universes. The problem is when you get a disadvantage of the size of a machine-type being doing its own thing with you and against you, you find that the scales of balance are kind of set up against this proposition of you emancipating yourself into the place that the great teachers said you could go, particularly the one that came to Judea. And I only say particularly that because it's my only experience in real terms of understanding the scale of what might be grander than humanity. And so what I'm trying to convince people in the book is take the evidence that you see before your eyes, derive it neutrally, do not bring your prejudices to bear. If you possibly can, have a look at this as neutrally as you possibly can, and then make the connections for yourself. Please don't believe what I say or what anyone else says. You are your own authority. For instance, I'll give you an example. The actual title of my book, it's not what I chose. It's a publisher's title, really. And it was rather embarrassing when I saw that. But, of course, the publisher had captured the inner essence of what I was trying to say. It is, in fact, a harvesting of our potential to be there forever. I'll just give you a little quote from the Bible. I mean, I'm not a great expert on the Bible, but from James. There are numerous accounts within many texts in the Coptic Gnostic Library, for instance, in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced by them. Surprising, isn't it? But
yeah.
It's there. Most notable of these explanations is that given in the first Apocalypse of James, in the Nag Hammadi Codex. And incidentally, while I say that, please, please look at all the authorities outside the four Gospels. Because I tell you what, these rascals in 324 AD, in the Council of Nicaea, whatever, took a lot of it out. And
sure
they did that with aplomb because they wanted to assert their own authority over humanity. And they distorted completely the lessons of the beautiful lifetime of this lovely being, this lovely Jew that appeared 2,000 years ago. I believe, incidentally, in my own terms, this is just my opinion, I believe that his entire sojourn on this earth was to, in fact, tell us how to deal with artificial life forms that are programmed of the sort that we are facing with, as the grace. So Jesus warns in James about entities that take away souls by theft. He then tells us how to deal with such entities and to try to allude to pre-existent beings that didn't have to face this. Now, by pre-existent beings, I think that quite fits in with my theory that it is a whole system of devolution. And I think that we came in with the universe, but pre-existence was before we became formularized as physical type beings through the simple cascade of effect that came when the universe cooled and all the rest of it and presented different forms of the manifestation of being as such. And pre-existent beings are beings, I believe, that we were like when we first came in, beings of light, full of information and understanding and so forth, that came out of an amalgam directly from the, as I said, the primal poles of the pole of harmony against its opposite, the pole of chaos. And so here we are now in our particular state, still beached, still stuck in this universe's parts, but always having ambassadors of goodwill, like the Buddha, like the prophet, the great Islamic prophet Muhammad. Yes, I mean, I know that that's perhaps not supposed to be spoken about, but I tell you, if you read the Quran in English, I think a lot of people will have a great surprise of how beautiful the sentiments are there. And of course, the great Judeo-Christian and prophet Jesus Christ and so forth. These were wondrous beings, and if we could get their words exactly as we spoke them, as they spoke them, we would have to be able to acknowledge that some great distortion has been done historically.
Since. Sure, sure. And you know,
and
you could have your pastor.
We do not believe them based upon these distortions.
You could have, you know, your own pastor, your own religious leader tell you whatever they want to tell you. But in your heart of hearts, in your soul, you know that Jesus spoke more than 45 minutes while he was on the earth. All those red words in that book are not all everything that he said and did.
I like the way you put that. Yes,
It's interesting that if you look at what he said all the time, he was saying things like whenever someone was healed, he didn't say I've healed you or God healed you. He said your faith made you whole.
Right.
He was always sort of showing that it was actually the individual human beings themselves who had the power. And he said, you see me do all these wondrous things. Don't you realize you can do all these things as well? Greater than these things can you do? So, and he referred to himself as the Son of Man, and he referred to God as the Father of everyone. Yet he was sort of, in a way, he was resisting what has happened since, that he's sort of put as an idol, as something that's unattainable, that was just, there was just only one example of ever, and just to show us what we can't be. He was actually showing us what we can be.
Yeah, and the problem you see, Brooks, is that when you get a undistorted view, as much as you can of an undistorted view as it's possible these days, from looking at the texts that have been thrown out by the Vatican or by all the councils of sort of, you know, Roman Catholic religion and whatever. And incidentally, somebody threw some water over me and called me a Catholic when I was a child. And I think I recovered and became a kind of, you know, humanist, if you like. You can get a much better and more accurate purview, I think, of what might be true. I stress, might be true. One never really knows.
Well, there's a difference between being religious and being spiritual. And I think that we've
I can't claim to be spiritual, but what I can say is I can understand why science takes a detracting view about this nonsense, as they call it, of religion and so forth, believing in an anthropocentric God and that kind of thing, a God that demands things of you and so forth. It sounds like some kind of super lord of the manor or super parent or whatever, and where you have to pay homage and worship and all the rest of it. But I think the greatest gift that has been given us by any kind of God-type principle, put in a secular way, is the freedom of will to be and understand things as we can make them, under guidance, using this wonderful paradigm of natural, neutral logic.
Well, when you break into that extra or that stuff that's been withdrawn from the truth, then you will not be surprised by the empirical experience of life. For instance, in your book, you say, the interface between the physical and non-physical universe, which is really what we struggle with as third-dimensional human beings, is the light, or two-dimensional deployment people claim to see in near-death experiences. You see, the near-death experience is the one surprise to religion. Religion won't let you accept the near-death experience because they don't.
And isn't that ironical, Brooks?
They don't want
you. Isn't that ironical?
Yeah, they don't want you to realize that you transcend the physical, that heaven is really here. There's no place you're being kept out of.
Christ said it as much. The kingdom of heaven is within you. You know?
Exactly.
And in the near-death experiences, against this sort of notion that people have culturally that God is going to be judging you and so on, that's not what people experience in the near-death experience. They see some being of light there with them that's showing them what they've done, and they experience what they did to others as though it were happening to them, which fits with this idea of us all being one ultimately and the neighbor being themselves. And it's their own conscience that is judging them and giving them this urge to put right what they have done once they realize and recognize it. And perhaps that's what draws us into coming back again. Now, this idea about memory is quite interesting, about why do we not remember, now about previous lives. Now, a very well-respected neuropsychiatrist, Peter Fenwick, who has done a lot of research into this these near-death experiences at the Institute of Psychiatry in London, he and his wife have been looking at the memories that people have that can be checked and verified to be shown that they'll remember an existence that they had previously in a previous incarnation and so on, things that they couldn't in that present life have known about. Now, it's interesting that a lot of the people that actually remember a previous life had a violent death during that life. Now, if you look at, for example, at the sleep laboratories, they show that we're all dreaming in all of our sleeps, but we only remember those dreams that we suddenly get woken up from. So there's actually no reference within the conscious mind, which is after all a derivative of combining our sentient mind into something physical to allow for a physical existence. We've got no references to compare against to a state before life, if you like, let alone a previous life, and that's why we don't tend to remember it. And also, if you think that perhaps if this idea is correct, that, that Schrödinger suggested that ultimately we came from a singularity where we were all one, and the fact that we're now separate as separate individuals is a sign that we've become restricted and limited and so on in our search to experience separation. Well, that momentum of being separate will tend to make us identify our existence in terms of the ego, the particular identity of the character of the human being that we're born as at that particular point in time, and we won't have an ability necessarily to see beyond that.
Yes, and it's a very, if I may just take a little time to take you through a regression experience that demonstrates this quite beautifully. It will fascinate your listeners. There was a regression subject. A regression is, of course, a kind of hypnotic process that takes you back in time. And it's done properly. It's a very, very reliable and well-reputed type of thing. The regression subject recalls some time ago. In fact, I saw a documentary done by the BBC here in the UK, showing this particular thing. A regression subject recalled that he was a Jew who lived in the town of York in England in the 14th century. Now, this chap claimed under hypnosis that he was burnt to death with others for his faith at the time in the synagogue during a pogrom against the Jews of York. And that's a very important historical time. Sadly, the British did this business at that time. The Jews were, in fact, subject to pogroms at that time. And the man described a whole series of events in intricate detail and identified the geography and the logistical outlay of medieval York with amazing accuracy. Now, much of it was historically known and recorded, but he claimed not to have had the slightest knowledge of medieval history of any kind, and was astonished at the detail he was able to give on the subject when later listening to the audio tape record of his regression. The man was really gobsmacked, if you like, by all he was saying. He just did not have a conscious recall of anything like this. He did, however, describe much that was not known or recorded historically about the town of York. He described that there was a synagogue and its site in medieval York and the various related logistics of this particular synagogue, this place. The experts affirmed there had never been a synagogue at the place he described, and these were university experts, I understand, from the University of Oxford. His description did not fit anything that was known about York, and they, of course, dismissed it, as all these experts tend to do, as nonsense. But some years later, the authorities gave permission for an archaeological dig in the old town site that he described, and lo and behold, buried many feet below the streets, the cobbled streets of old York, as surviving today, they discovered the old synagogue in exactly the place the man had described under regression.
Wow.
Now, the audio tape record affirmed the entire series of events that had led to the man's death. He described how a group of Jews were chased and cornered in a synagogue. He described how they were chased from room to room, round corners, to a point in the synagogue where he succumbed to a fire that the people had set. He described himself, sitting against a wall when he died in one of the galleries of the synagogue. He described a medallion in great detail that he wore round his neck. Now, this is the amazing thing. To the utter astonishment of all those who investigated his claim, a skeleton was discovered in the exact place he described that he died. Described by this man. And around the skeleton's neck was the medallion he described absolutely exactly. Now, many people say that reincarnation is an ancient memory that is retained because somebody's read it somewhere in some historical record. But all that can't apply to this because nobody knew that this place existed. There was no historical record of a synagogue in ancient York. So he could not have read that. And somehow this man was able to recite this past existence in intricate detail. Now, I tell you, there are many, many stories such as this. I'm just, you know, quoting this as a single example. Let me tell you, I was a little bit, averse to this idea that we've lived many times before and so on. And after doing the research I've had to do, that has culminated in the books I've written, I think I have to say that I'm totally convinced that we live again.
Well, I can tell you, having read a lot and interviewed a lot of experts on this field, that I support that idea. And I don't know about Dr. Fenwick's work, but I have read where memories are being recovered very clear about lives that are not even lived on this planet. They're lived on other planets. And the appearance of the being on that planet is not completely human.
I accept that, you know. In my third book, I speculate this, and I can't prove it. But I think that the way we travel interstellar space, so to speak, in this universe, is not in mechanically made, materially made ships because of the Einsteinian limit and the speed of light and the gathering of mass and all the rest of it. I really think that is for robots and machines that can withstand huge, huge pressures, inertial pressures and all of this. I think the way we travel is through death. I think the whole universe is open to us, where there is no speed limit, where things might happen in terms of space-time in fractions of seconds. And I think the entire universe, therefore, is open to us. And maybe we may not reincarnate back again in this particular juncture that we leave, i.e. the Earth. We might do that through this intricate process that is described by the Hindus and Eastern religions as karma and whatever. If you have some kind of debt to somebody that you are responsible for, you know, in terms of, you know, some injustice or whatever, you may have to return to repay that debt. I really don't know about that, but I can see that there is some logic to that. But I think that in a sense, if that you don't have any debts or that kind of thing, that's a wonderful venue or ability to move right across the universe. And I, in my second book, I don't even remember actually the title of the book, Song of the Graces, my first one.
Yeah.
I'm not particularly, as you can see, I'm not particularly concerned about my books. I just put these things down and offer them to the world.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Well, I want to know.
One of these commercial types of minds, let me tell you.
I want to know the real title of this book, because I want to scratch out your...
Yes. I know, it scared me when I first saw it, what they had chosen, my publishers, but because it was one of the biggest publishers in America, who am I to discuss and talk about marketing strategies and so on? But please forgive me for the title. It's not mine. It's actually, it's a very, it's Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Actually, is the center of the thesis that I say, but it's a series of three books that I'm doing to try to account for the whole story. You can't just do, not even in a radio program, Brooks.
No, 3 hours is not enough time, I can tell you.
It's 3 hours. Well, it's difficult.
it might, you know, prove to be the ultimate frustration of these beings. I don't know. In your book, you say the trouble is that these... And you put in quote, demons of the universe, do not understand why. They cannot understand the mechanism that unites with Godhead, because they are entities derived wholly and utterly from a purely physical and material paradigm. They're not spiritual beings.
They're made out of atoms. They're made out of of living being with life invective, you know. They're made out of that resource, basically. And I can tell you, that I can pass you on to Dr. Bickerstaff, who has some ideas about this kind of thing.
Well,
yeah. I mean, this comes back to what we were speaking about earlier about the derivation of human beings and what we are, and as I said before, these things are entirely machines. Now, really, if we look at the nature of the universe being the juxtaposition between these two poles, if you like, we've got one bit mixed in with the other. And really, I think that maps in our sort of universal understanding as much as we understand in science and sort of cosmology and et cetera at the moment is, you know, once we look beyond the atomic boundary, which, of course, one must appreciate is not really a solid little ball with little electrons. These electrons or the edges of the atoms are really where they're in fact viewed to be. Because, you know, without viewing them in theory and in physics, as I'm sure you'll agree, these things can effectively be everywhere. Nevertheless, we can have a sort of a space between these atoms at which the forces cancel out. Really, this is a sort of Lagrangian point. And, of course, we have these between planets. But, in fact, we have those between every atom. But one can immediately see that the atomic frame itself, really, atoms are really confined to being able to touch other atoms, and so they really define limit within their own sense. If we take this continuum between the atoms, effectively, we effectively have this Lagrangian or this zero point cancellation. I mean, this is one of the principles of why they're trying to get the idea of things like zero point energy. This is part of the principle of this, but in fact, if this is where consciousness lies, which is, you know, what quantum physics is suggesting and Hameroff and Penrose are actually suggesting this comes from, then really this continuum is the opposite of what the atoms are. So the atoms are all separate and touching each other and have limit in terms of their effect, whereas the continuum, in fact, between them, is, in fact, encompasses the whole universe. And
if I may just interpose that, because of that zero effect somewhere where all forces are balanced, you get a parody, you know, you see, Brooks, of the Godverse, where all things have no force. And within that paradigm, you get all knowing. That's where I believe thought is made, or thoughtness happens.
So in many ways, one can consider that thoughtness being straight, if you like, or as part of a continuum, and therefore everywhere, can in fact, as it becomes more and more devolved, if you like, or enforced, effectively starts to shake and generates waves, which effectively end up being really being sort of self-limiting, which is really what an atom is. I mean, I think if everything really came from nothing at the beginning of the universe and everything's really made out of the same stuff, it's just in different operations or different conformational states during this. Now, the problem is that if we take a bunch of atoms and we get them to linearly or sequentially connect with each other in terms of these little electric potentials, then whatever we make is really just made out of the atoms. It's actually got no access really to the other side of the argument, which is the continuum of the other half of the universe, and within this continuum is where living being effectively comes from. This is why we're essentially isolated from the second law of thermodynamics as structures within there, because the second law, or entropy, if you like, really only applies to really the atomic to force processes, and therefore that a being, if you like, a facsimile of a human being made in such a way, although it would appear to have intelligence, and bear in mind we are devolving in terms of our technologies, really the more technology we put onto ourselves, the more we look like them and appreciate really that degree of limit, we're effectively the same. So it becomes, it blurs the line as to whether, you know, how different we are from them. But in fact, this difference is intrinsic. And therefore, the greys, if you like, these little roboids, really in trying to piggyback on us to get this sort of eternal quality, if you like, outside of the physics, the laws of physics within the atomic frame, is really an impossible function.
The greys are just simply, I think, utilitarian creations to be able to withstand inertias in physical atomic enforced space. Can you imagine if a biological structure like us, right, were to ride the speeds they would have to do and to come down and decelerate and move in right angles at maybe 25,000 miles an hour, as some of our most reliable witnesses, pilots, whatever, have seen them do. If we did that, we'd be a stain on the window inside a spaceship, would we not, Brooks?
Well, there's the idea that they create, you know, their own unified field in there, and that they're not actually experiencing those forces on the inside of the vehicle.
No, indeed. But in fact, there would be a problem. And so, you know, in terms of all accounts and the research I have done from various people at very high levels in some parts of our planet, Russian, Chinese, whatever, that I've had to interview and get some perspective from, they reckon that these gray entities are in fact made from a gold, a kind of mulch of gold wires set in between a mercury type medium and so forth. And I tell you what, as I speak, I know there are people in the United States of America who know exactly what I'm saying. Now, these things are really utilitarian mechanisms to be able to move within a physical frame of existence. Now, Dr. Bickerstaff is actually describing that which is not open to them, the space between atoms, the point at which there is no force. Within that comes all that is resolved in inspiration, thought, knowing, understanding, the wonders of the ability to see and perceive. And this is the real component of being, of our being, really, in terms of our kind of hope to be, you know, existentially beings that do not end in a finite sense. So I think that it is extremely important to make a distinction between the two. And I believe further, and obviously there will be many people who will take this as a bone of contention, and that is, I believe that our thinkability, our knowability, our understandability, sorry about to philologists about the English language, but, you know, there are no words sometimes to kind of describe
the concept. No, we make our own here on this program.
They've come into my mind. I think, you know, that we are an aerial for picking up this facility, that our bones that are piezoelectric, if we move, rather like you'd move in the old days, I'm sure you had these aerials on the top of TV sets where you manipulated each arm to get the best picture. I think that in a sense, that's why we get into prayer mode, where we move in certain ways and so on. I think in some kind of way, we can receive, if you like, this mechanism from within us, within our own atoms, by manipulating a piezoelectric quotient moved by our bones and so on, and understand a little bit more. That's why when we pray, we raise our arms, or we kneel down, or we lie flat on the ground or whatever. We actually are trying to improve reception, if you like, of what is coming through the center point of the space between atoms, i.e. from this incredible other universe, the Godverse, where I think all the great teachers were trying to, you know, try and encourage us to release ourselves from, and through death go. I believe that Jesus' transfiguration, as he demonstrated before he went into Jerusalem to Peter, James, and John, I think, I don't know if you have any kind of Christian background, but if you, there was this instance described in the Bible where he stretched forth his arms and he glowed brighter than the sun. And I think that he was, in some way, by using compunction, will, or whatever, and doing wonderful things that united rather than divided, he unscrewed his hydrogen, made it less atomically kind of sticky with one another, you know, in diatomic hydrogen, whatever, and he therefore was in a state of different human resolution, if you like. And then by the time they came to his crucifixion, he was almost ready to dissolve his atomic nature. And that, and in that tomb, as Dr. Silverman described, he completed the process in 3 days, and something wondrous happened. I tell you what, I think from his words, if you take his words to be true, and I certainly, not being a, you know, a convinced Catholic or Christian or whatever tribal thing they tried to stamp on me. Just looking at it from a science point of view, I absolutely now am convinced that this guy demonstrated where we all want to be. And most important of all, we all can go if we believe enough that we can do this.
Well, I think that there are probably more people at that state than one would want to admit. You know, there are about 7 billion of us here on the planet right now. And honestly, what you're describing to me, this thought connection, this point in between matter, it sounds like the singularity from which we came still exists. Mm. And in some sense, at least from the one perspective that we are capable of reaching in meditation or in prayer, the Big Bang never happened.
Yes.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm very impressed with your powers of thinking.
Well, I appreciate that.
Now, talking about this connection between mind and matter, Schrödinger was always a pains to point out that he said people wonder how the two things can interrelate. But we only wonder at that because as scientists, we've made an artificial distinction. With this empirical method, we've tried to imagine that there's some physical universe that's outside of the mind and not at all related to the mind, and that's what we spend all our time studying. Now, the point is that he showed is that actually they're all one, that it's a continuum of mind and matter together. Now, there's a couple of little anecdotes that I mentioned at my talk in Italy on the Shroud about this. One is there was an inaugural lecture by the newly appointed professor of parapsychology, the first one in the UK, where he was talking about, does such a thing as psi exist? You know, this idea of extrasensory perception, mind of matter. So at question time at the end, I just raised my arm, and when the chairman pointed to me to ask my question, I didn't ask a question, I just said, I'd just like to say, in raising my arm, I've proved, at least to myself, the existence of mind over matter. We're all doing it all the time, every single moment of every day. When we're using our free will, we're all using mind over matter. Otherwise, how do we control what we do?
And or heal.
The other one, sorry?
Or heal, or anything else. That
anything at all, anything at all. Whether it's, you know, writing a piece of paper on a piece of paper, whether it's going to the toilet, or anything that we do, we're using our free will. However mundane it is, we're showing the fundamental power of mind over matter. Now, the other point was when Professor Sir Herman Bondi came to
exclude seeing a pretty girl from that, by the way.
when Professor Sir Herman Bondi came to give a talk about Einstein, and at the end at question time, I put it to him, Einstein's time dilation equation, that suggests that at the speed of light, there's time becomes irrelevant, that you can be everywhere instantly all at once. So how about if an observer, if a sentient being could do that? Could we also be everywhere all at once and time become irrelevant to us? And his reply was, well, that's of course forbidden because observers have mass and you'd approach infinite mass as you become. And then I said to him, hang on a second, how heavy is a mind? How much mass does a thought have? Theoretically, if there was such a thing as a light being rather than a material being, could we be everywhere all at once?
Absolutely.
And he agreed that the equations allowed for that possibility, although he didn't think that was an interesting question, he said.
But the problem is,
well,
you see, I think he thought
a
thought was, in fact, as heavy as a person who thought it.
and also limited to the speed of light.
So that's, for me, the clue about the image on the Turin Shroud is it's the interface between separate identity as one person and being the all, being the whole, what he referred to as our father, if you like, the original singularity that all human beings came from.
Yeah, I think this business of the Turin Shroud was quite simply an amazing resolution into the future where this being actually saw that there would be so many people who would doubt everything that was said and so forth. He saw, I think, foresaw what men do. They distort in their own interests and so forth. They lose a wonderful sense of hope based on reality and truth because there is this sense of wanting perhaps to survive in a hostile environment of diminishing returns.
One thing that might have lost as well is the act of choice that this great being had to be born and go through at least one of his lives here on this earth.
But I tell you what, mate, I think that, you know, forgive me the familiar invective, but that's the way we talk to people we like over here. can we say this? But this guy actually is doing exactly what developed and wondrous being out there in the universe, perhaps in planets less enforced than ours, will do anyway. Let's look at what would happen if we walk on the street with some friends of ours and somebody falls down. Our immediate response is to bend down and help that individual up or try to make sure that he was all right. That is a intuitive.
Are they in New York City or is this somewhere else?
Well, actually, you're quite right. I walked in New York some years ago, and I passed three dead bodies on the street, and people just walked past them. And I thought to myself, goodness, there's a lot to be taught in this place. But you know what I mean, I think,
sure.
Brooke, that most human beings would immediately bend down and pick the individual up. So our intrinsic nature is one to unite, is to bring things together. And maybe 200,000 odd years ago, a bit of bacterium with its mitochondria was introduced for other purposes by an alien mechanism that actually then made us more expedient in their value terms rather than ours. And that, I think, may be a lesson we all have to investigate at least. I'm not claiming that that is true. As I have to say now, I'm not claiming anything I say is true. I put the things down in the book to ask people to consider this with their best auspices, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yes, and I like the implications that there really is no bearded being out there in the universe saying, you go to heaven, you go to hell, you go to heaven, you go to hell. We are sentient beings that judge ourselves moment by moment, instantaneous.
Yeah. And that's a lovely thing, is that we have no lording over things in our own personal being. We are the only lord we are. And that's the glory of it all, that we have that enormous power, that we can do that for ourselves, that each individual has total free will. And just simply by changing your mind and accepting truly, deeply, that something is right or wrong, we can structure the progress of our future.
Well, maybe we don't have to marshal a high-tech army or a secret government to protect ourselves against the Greys. Maybe we just need to be aware that
that's the secret. That's the secret. Whatever they may do to us, whatever the cartels are, whatever these things might have been promised by the Greys that may be controlling our planet, maybe for some future scope where they want to claim the whole darn thing by taking the rest of us out. You know, there are people who suggested that to me. Some people in the Russian Air Force suggested that this may be a paradigm that is suitable to describe why people are hiding this from the rest of the world.
Right.
In fact, I had two American colonels say this to me, too. They had the same kind of idea. Now I find that some of your most distinguished individuals, including astronauts, are claiming that they have personally verified that there is an entity outside the scope of our planet that has a technology that they have witnessed, and you know, that's good enough for me, mate, I'll tell you.
Well, it's disconcerting to sit there with the medals all over your chest, the stars on your shoulders, and be able to say
But America is more than medals on the chest and stars on your shoulder. America was conceived by some very wise and beautiful men. And if America is what America should be, that's one thing. But what America or any country has to do is to try to strive for what it should be against what men and some unworthy men might make of it.
Yes. I totally agree. And I think that the embarrassment comes from, the energy of secrecy comes from not being able to assure the people over which they have purview.
You bet. You bet.
They cannot guarantee the sovereignty of the airspace.
That's
they cannot prevent
true.
These beings from picking us like lice out of the hair of the dog at will by the millions and either returning us or not returning us. They can't admit to the world that they can do nothing about that. And so they keep it secret.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I remember as a young person, you know, being enthralled by the beauty that I saw in America. For instance, I mean, I really don't want to make this in some kind of patriotic sense for America, but I have to say this from the UK point of view, shall we say. I mean, I remember seeing lovely films like, you know, This Wonderful Life and you know, or Moonlight Bay and all the rest of it, where there was something sweet and gentle and really neat, if you like, about the American way of outlook and so forth. And yet, look at what has happened now. Under the stream of some very unworthy men, perhaps, I won't name names, but that lovely leadership that once, you know, made everybody love America, Walt Disney or whatever.
Yeah, we abdicated it.
Seems to have taken a holiday, shall we say. We are hoping that there are still some in there being, you know, one of the world's greatest influencers and so forth, in opinion and so forth, that maybe some way it may start again. But what we have are paranoid people thinking the most awful things, seeing different outlooks as a threat instead of a partnership. To try to work things out and so forth.
There you have it.
Instead of trying to preach this in some kind of, I'm sorry. I hope I don't sound some holier than thou individual. But really, as an ordinary individual,
no, not at all.
Like children, this is what I would hope for.
Herodotus said that it is the death of any government when the people can vote for themselves a piece of the coffer. And what has happened is politicians in our country have played upon that public greed. And have literally hired the public to vote for them. And that's the condition we find ourselves in. $1.3 trillion deficit.
Yeah. And
it's got to stop.
That's true. That's true, yeah. But, I mean, you know, whatever the deficit might be and whatever contrivances there might be. You know, I was reading a book recently by a chap called Nick Redfern. It really is something that people... I'm not selling this, but let me tell you, it is something I really was struck by. It's a book called Final Events and the Secret Government Group on demonic UFOs and the afterlife, or whatever. And Nick is just a commentator. He just presents evidence. He has no views of his own. And he talks about a kind of cartel in the U.S. government called the Collins Elite. And it really just opened my eyes as to what paradigms might exist there that we might face. And I think, you know, it's something that people ought to take a look at, quite simply to be able to decide for themselves where we as a natural, notional entity called humanity might be going, especially in the face of an apparent threat like we are finding with this phenomenon of UFOs and the Greys and so on.
Well, I like Nick Redfern. I've had him on the program. He's at least he's an open-minded journalist, and he brings great ideas together.
That's a wonderful thing, yes. I think that he does. He does have a neutral sense about all of this. He just presents it. And, of course, some people might find ideas that are bizarre, and some people might find that ideas that actually hold together. But I think it is something, you know, there is no risk at all in looking as wide as possible.
No,
in fact, the wider the field of knowledge, the greater would be the ability for us to decide where the truth might lie. And the more you narrow down your vision, the less you will be able to understand. It's a very simple, logical paradigm, surely.
Yes. And half the battle is just getting everyone to agree that they exist. Then once we realize
it... Look for evidence without prejudice. Look for it as neutrally as you can. Take away the prejudices hitched up to your eyes, for instance. Those are the most dangerous. You know, this guy's nose is bigger, or this guy's color is slightly less than pink, or whatever.
Right.
Those things are very, very dangerous, because what you do is you divorce yourself from any place that you might have to, for instance, expedite a karmic debt. And I believe that karma is simply cause and effect. If you did something in some kind of lifetime, to do an injustice to somebody, you can be absolutely sure if there is a singularity that brings everything together, you might call God, you have to be absolutely sure that that singularity would demand the adjustment of that balance.
That's right. You will be sent back to this earth white.
Absolutely. You send yourself back, because I think no one does the sending, you know. I think there is no such thing as an independent resolution except the power of the singularity that demands recompense in some kind
of way. Which is your own conscience. Remember, that singularity is within you, within everyone. So having that within you, you're... see yourself reflected against it and see where you've gone wrong.
And that's the beautiful thing that NDEs show, because NDEs actually show that particular thing in many, many experiences one reads, that there's a life review, and it shows you without judgment, without any kind of sense of punishment, whatever, where you went wrong and where you might be right.
As we said, people report experiencing where they've gone wrong, what they've done to other human beings that was detrimental, they feel that being done to them, as though they actually are all one, which would make sense if that's actually what we are, and that's what logic and reason suggest, as Schrödinger realized.
Well, so I suggest you learn from people's near-death experiences so that when your complete death experience happens...
Absolutely.
You'll be empowered.
Of course, you know, the problem there, sorry to interrupt you, Brooks, but the problem there is that, you know, we have this subjective element in us that always looks to propagate our own self-interest. And that comes, I think, out of something that seeks to preserve ourselves as ourselves. Now, that might be a worthy thing, but when that goes over the top, so to speak, used over the top, then we begin to cause a big problem.
Mm. Well, the other extreme to that is the Christ. So you need to decide where along that spectrum you belong and where you want to be, and if you
I think that's what really brings this book entirely together.
Yeah, is that, you know,
Nigel ends his book with this treatise on the shroud, and Andrew has gone through how a man can effectively translate himself almost pretty well out of the universe, because the way in which this image was made on this shroud meant that the body had to physically disappear. And really, you know, that's consistent with evidence we have at the moment about quantum foams, etc., really encompassing two-dimensional and one-dimensional structures. Of course, those are not going to be directly observable from a three-dimensional universe. And as Nigel said, you know, the body itself can untwist its atoms, etc. And we've established that the thought process, in fact, is responsible for both twisting and through free will, as Andrew said, we can choose to untwist at the same time. And I think this is what brings the whole story together, is that what teachers like Jesus, Buddha, etc., we're really suggesting is that if one changes one's mind from a separationist point of view to bringing things together point of view, we can unravel the atoms and effectively use our biochemistry against its origin towards devolution and actually reverse that process, so we can actually go to this singularity where really we don't have to come back anymore, because we're actually a part of that original function.
That's the goal. That's the goal right there.
And we don't, no one punishes us, Brooks. We punish ourselves.
Sure.
And that's the most important rule of all. We punish ourselves for the lack of our insight and so forth. And that's what we see in what we call the rooms of death before we come back again in another lifetime to try to correct it. The problem is, where do we reincarnate? We may not be able to reincarnate in the actual situation where we need to be. We might have to take a secondary place, if you like, and then finding our way in a physical life, which means we have to grow up and understand enough and so on. Okay. There is a delay mechanism. So there's a lot of detritus and noise to have to go through to do it this way. We might as well do it in one lifetime if we got the truth.
Yes.
You know, in the end, if we've got this problem about, you know, greys or existentially, you know, things like the greys, machines or whatever, coming and interfering with this natural process, we have a problem. The greys can only exist for life, I think. They are adapting us for their kind of existence, heading only for the only immortality that they can know.
Well, maybe we draw them in and coax them out of their machines.
You bet. They do. We draw them in. And now you've seen the most salient point of all. We draw them in by our ignorance.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, we're completely out of time. I have to tell you, it's been a fantastic experience, Nigel, and Drs. Biggerstaff and Silverman. I really appreciate your input. We have had one of the most lively conversations that I think I've ever had on X Squared Radio. I love the book. The publisher calls it Gray Aliens and the Harvesting of the Souls. I don't know what Nigel's title for the book is, but maybe he'll tell us. It's available everywhere, so go out and get a copy. It's substantial, and I promise you'll like it. I appreciate you coming on the program. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the plug.
Thank you, Robert. And
most of all, thank you for your patience and your understanding and the fact that you weren't tempted to interrupt, because I'll tell you what, you have greater patience than I have.
My producer doesn't like that, actually. He wants me to interrupt you and step on you. And I tell him, look, this is X Squared Radio. In here, the results are always positive, okay? Everything we put into that function comes out positive. That's why our listeners come here. So I let you pontificate
to the max. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you very much, and good day to you gentlemen there in the UK. I know it's late. Thank you very much.
Well,
for
if there's a God, may bless you and your producer.
Well, I accept the blessings and return them to you tenfold.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having us.
All right. Well, that's it for X Squared Radio. It will be Sunday when you hear this. We actually recorded this on September 30th because of time constraints and scheduling, and very, very gracious to be able to put this together for you. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio, saying, peace, Earth Explorers.